masters, almost surely have a plan. There's clearly maybe something there beyond the realm of man. Until we've thoroughly tested every last close-chested view, find the more you think you know, the less you really do. Where would we be without THC? We know the lying to us, just don't know to what degree. Where would we be without THC? The highest side chat show. Greg Carwood and Company.
Higher Side Chatters, we have read between enough lines by now to know that a carefully crafted box of convention has been placed over our mundane modern lives, and people have become more enthralled with scrolling through their phones than discovering the real mysteries, magic, and rich hidden history that's usually all around them. Ley lines, energy vortexes, sacred geometry, ancient mounds, ruins that align with the night sky, cannibalistic giants, healing hot springs, the amplification and harnessing of the Earth's natural energy flow, etc., etc. Of course, many of these things are spread all across America, and while a lot of Americans might be enamored by the Giza Plateau, Göbekli Tepe, or the stone circles of the British Isles, sadly, we are largely ignorant of the sullied history of our own surroundings. Most likely because the official version minimizes the crimes of the European invasion, but also because many of the colonialists and early founders were deeply embedded in the esoteric arts, Freemasonry, and a plethora of other secret societies, and they have both co-opted the environmental magic that was used by the people who were here before, and also built and ritualized many of their own structures and monuments that harness these very same forces they'd rather you just know nothing about. Well, we've talked about the Freemasonic layout of Washington, D.C. nearly to death, but we know the American landscape holds many other things of interest, and that brings me to today's guest, Corey Daniel. Corey is a third-generation Phoenician, writer, researcher, and professional guide currently living in the Phoenix, Arizona area, and he has spent most of his life immersing himself in his environment and learning all he can about desert flora, Native American cultures, religion, physics, poetry, botany, philosophy, primitive survival, traditional archery, and the occult. He's since taken his passion and knowledge to the net with the Phoenix Enigma, a deeply fascinating website devoted to decoding and reverse engineering the esoteric symbolism, history, and mystery of the magical microcosm that is Phoenix, Arizona. He's blown my mind more than once, and I wish every major city had someone so dedicated to digging out the good stuff. The teller of untold tales, an esoteric Arizonian explorer extraordinaire, Corey Daniel, welcome to the Higher Side.
Thank you for the intro very much. I appreciate that.
Yes.
I wish everyone was so enthusiastic about my work as you are. It'd be great.
I think they will be, man, because I mean, there is just so much to talk about. I know we're not going to get to it all, and I've been really looking forward to this for a couple of weeks. It's become really one of my favorite types of shows to do, a deep look into one area or city full of rich history and mystery to unpack. We've talked to guests who have become similar types of scholars about places like the Susquehanna River or the city of Philadelphia. And I'm just pretty psyched to expose the audience to the awesome stuff you've uncovered about the Phoenix area. And maybe to kick this off, you can give us a little overview of your thoughts on Phoenix, Arizona, now that you've learned all these things, and maybe a bit of how you got all that insight. I mean, this is not the kind of stuff you come across every day, you know?
No, you're right. It's not. It didn't all come at once. It was me growing up in Phoenix. And tell you the truth, there was really no interest in my own town until I moved out of it. And I moved to the western part of the state when I was about 18, cowboyed for a few years and ran the family business. We owned operated gas stations. But that gas station where I went to was in the middle of nowhere. It's about 300 people halfway to Las Vegas from Phoenix. It's called Wickiup, Arizona. And that town is probably one of the most mysterious places, in my opinion, in Arizona. And I met an old hippie that had been living there, and he was into the occult and Egypt and the ancient mysteries. I befriended him, and we just roamed those deserts for years out there. And when I moved back to Phoenix, everything that I had become out there in that desert with my hometown coming back at me, I just started studying, and I don't know why. And I started recognizing all the pyramids around Phoenix, and then I got into the history a little bit. Then I became a tour guide. I had to reinvent myself after 08, 09. The crash came, and like a lot of people, we lost everything we had, and I became a tour guide and just dove in 100% into the history of Phoenix, and that's when everything coalesced. And if you have a background in the occult, and you have a background in botany or pharmakia or witchcraft as we know it, and you start putting it together with the modern day pieces of art that's commissioned and the speeches, and then it just rolled, to make a long story short. And there's a point at which all knowledge really does dovetail, whether you're talking about Western history or botany or the occult. There's a point where it all intersects, and that's where I'm at. And my bubble is Phoenix, and I'm glad it is, because it is a rich, untapped, undiscovered nest and hive of Freemasonry, and that's what I've been concentrating on for the past 4 years here.
Yes, it seems like a real hotbed for ancient civilization, as well as being established in this round of human history as a Freemasonic ritual, or I don't know, experiment or haven. And both of these things speak to some natural qualities that certain people appreciate and others miss entirely. But if we were going to focus on the naming or the founding of Phoenix or even the whole state of Arizona, these are loaded names that mean something to people in the know. How did they get them? Because you seem to be of the mindset that this was a very calculated Freemasonic operation from the start, right?
Yeah. So I'm going to give a somewhat of a long answer here, but it's going to come back around the conversation when we get there later on. To understand everything about Phoenix and why it is a hive of Freemasonry, you have to understand the ancient culture that used to be here. Anthropologists and archaeologists, they group Native Americans kind of into two groups: tribes after 1500 or Spanish European contact, and cultures prior to that, because we really don't know a lot about them. And we just kind of separate them by artwork and burial rites, trading patterns, and architecture. In the Phoenix area was a culture by the name of the Hohokam, H-O-H-O-K-A-M, Hohokam. And that's a Pima word, and that's a local tribe today. And the word Hohokam means those who were vanquished or those who were all used up. They were here between about 300 BC and 1425 AD. And they were known for doing primarily two things, one of which was digging canals. They constructed a canal system in the Phoenix Basin, or the Salt River Valley, of over 1,000 miles of canals. 200 miles of which were called trunk canals. They're about 70 feet across by 20 feet deep. And if you're good at math, that's about 54.6 million cubic yards of earth. Those then fed out into feeder canals and distribution canals, another 800 miles of canals, about 20 feet across by 5 feet deep, and they irrigated 100,000 acres of land.
Wow.
Yeah, this isn't a bunch of spear chucking, hide wearing, wagon burning savages. You got some serious engineering going on here, and this is where I first dove in, and this is the beginning of my journey. That's why I'm starting here. When the founding fathers got here, they found the canals were all covered in. The floods that had happened from 1425 since had just covered in all these canals, and that's when the Hohokam dispersed. But before we get there, know that these canals are dug to a perfect gradient of 3 to 4 feet of drop per mile. And the reason why that gradient is important, because for the silt in the Salt River, it's the perfect gradient so that it doesn't, i.e., tear out the sides of the canals, or it doesn't deposit and fill them up. They used weirs, which is a 3/4 dam pointing upflow, so it pressurizes the water to get it to go over a hill or pump it uphill a little bit. They utilized floodgates, and they farmed fish in these canals. Their main crop was cotton, which harkens to Egypt, if you're thinking along the lines here. In fact, today, the Pima Indians still produce a cotton called Pima cotton. If you've ever bought that, men's shirts and sheets are made out of Pima cotton, the second finest cotton on earth. And that's because the botanist came here in 1905, found this cotton that had been grown for 2,000 years in the Phoenix Basin, and hybrid it with an Egyptian strain. And they still grow it today. But to the point here, you have this ancient culture called the Hohokam, who constructed over 1,000 miles of canals to a perfect gradient. They had no written language. They left no mathematics. They had no metallurgy skills. They had no wheel, and they had no pack animal. Supposedly, they dug these canals with sharp sticks and flat rocks, and they moved the dirt with baskets from yucca cactus fiber. Okay. Their other accomplishment was platform mounds. We know the biggest platform mound in the United States to be at Cahokia in southern Illinois. Mm-hmm. It has a footprint of about 14 acres. That's 1 acre bigger than the Pyramid of Giza, you know, the Great Pyramid on the Giza Plateau. You don't see any platform mounds again till you get out to Phoenix. And when the founding fathers got here, they found 48 of them, three of which are still around. The rest have been demolished in the late 1800s, early 1900s, because it was primarily farming area. And they had to bulldoze them down and blade them down so they could plant. In fact, if you had a canal, if you had an ancient Hohokam canal or a platform out on your property, it was worth less money back in the day, the turn of the century, because you had to do work before you could plant it, strangely enough. Mm-hmm. But all this history just got bulldozed over and is still today underneath modern day Phoenix. You can go to parks in central Phoenix and south Phoenix, and you go in the back there and you will find pottery shards all the time. All this history is very real and relevant today. When the founding fathers got here about when they named Phoenix in 1868, there was a couple primary fathers that I've written about, a guy named Lord Darrell Dupa and a fellow by the name of Jack Swilling. We know Lord Dupa was a high-ranking Freemason, rumored to be a 32nd, but no one really has any proof of that. He came from a well-to-do family in, I think it was Wales, I believe. And he traveled the whole world, found his way to Phoenix, and made this his home. Him and Jack Swilling and a bunch of other founding fathers were sitting on some ruins, some Hohokam ruins, about a mile from the airport right now. It's called Pueblo Grande. It is a museum, and it talks about those platform mounds and all those canals I just told you about. Pretty cool. It's like $5 to get in, and you get to walk up on top of this platform mound, one of three left. And they're trying to decide what to name our town, and our name was called Pumpkinville. That was our first name. Not a lot of people know that. It was Pumpkinville. Everyone hated it. We almost became known as Swilling after Jack. They almost named us Stonewall because most of the founding fathers were veterans from the War of Northern Aggression. We almost became known as Salina after the Salty River. The Salt River runs through Phoenix. But Lord Darrell Dupa stood up, and he says, "Gentlemen, this canal was constructed in an age now forgotten. Prehistoric cities lie in ruins all around you. A great ancient civilization once thrived in this valley. Let the new city arise from its ashes. Let it be called Phoenix." Damn. And that's how we got our name. Yeah. It harkens right back to the Hohokam. We were named for this ancient culture. Pretty cool. He also went on to name the town of Tempe. You know, you've heard of Tempe, Arizona, right? Mm-hmm. ASU. Mm-hmm. Well, Tempe was named by Lord Darrell Dupa as well. And if you've ever gone to Greece, there is a valley called the Vale of Tempe or the Vale of Tempe. And it's not unlike Thermopylae. It's a strategic location. It's a gorge that runs through this rocky outcropping. And there's only one way through it. Well, the Greek believed that when the gods put on their mortal coils and came down, they spent their time hanging out in this beautiful temperate green place down there. Well, if you've ever been to Tempe, Arizona, there is a rock outcropping on both sides of the 202 freeway that goes through there, and it's called the Papago Mountains. And that is a conglomerate rock formation that rises out of the alluvial fill of the Phoenix Basin. And what that does is it pushes the water, the Salt River water, up to the surface there. So even in times of drought, back in the ancient days, there was always water right at Tempe, Arizona. Well, this spot in the 1800s reminded Lord Dupa of Tempe, Greece. So he named it Tempe, Arizona.
Wow.
If you travel the rest of our state, you will find Egyptian names from southern Arizona all the way to especially the Grand Canyon. There's tons of Egyptian and Hindu names all through the Grand Canyon. The Masons really got here first and they claimed it. They grabbed all the resources, they implemented their institutions, and today they're still allocating these resources and managing them for whomever. I don't pretend to know all that, but that's kind of where it's at today.
Very interesting, man. And I've interviewed so many guests and researchers about the idea that when it comes to the elite, they have this secret religion. So much of what they do has Egyptian or Babylonian symbolism. It's drenched all over the place. And they have a tendency to try to rebuild or recreate biblical events and locations. And it seems like Phoenix, Arizona, and the surrounding area, there, you know, there might be something in that mix, making a city of modern Phoenicians. I mean, phonetically, they pay a lot of attention to those types of details, it seems.
Yes, they do. If you follow Western civilization, we know that Sumeria was the first, right? Mm-hmm. And from there, Egypt came out. And of course, you had the Minoans and the Phoenicians and all the other Jaredite cultures in there. From there, it went into Greece and then into Rome and then into England or Europe, right? And London actually means New Rome. I'm sure you know that. Mm-hmm. And then we came over to the United States and we have Washington, D.C., or the District of Columbia. Mm-hmm. Columbia is the goddess Isis. And then we had the Western expansion across the United States. It's just one big continuation with the same religion, the same backbone, the same gods and goddesses with new names, but it's the same ceremony and religion and dogma all the way through. Once you learn how to read it, you can just go right back and just connect the dots all the way back to the beginning. You can even go back and I've studied other people's work and you can study the people in charge. They're the same people, the same families, you know, we all know that.
I just love how this local research you're doing ties into the big story. And speaking of weird secret beliefs of the elite, I was also really interested in Hunt's tomb. For people who aren't familiar, George W.P. Hunt was Arizona's first governor, and he had a pyramid tomb built in 1931 for his family and himself. You also note that this isn't an arbitrary thing because it's the exact same size as the capstone of the Great Pyramid was. Of course, it's not there now, but dimensionally, it fits. And he was a high-ranking Freemason who oversaw the dedication of every Masonic lodge founded in Arizona when he was alive. So he really seems to know some stuff. And Egyptian mysteries and sacred geometry are always just a big part of that knowledge. I guess, what else do you find interesting about Hunt or his tomb?
You know, I was there this week, and it's just kind of on the way home. And I stop there and walk up there, sit next to this tomb, and I just think sometimes. And yeah, there is a pyramid. Technically, it is a capstone, as it measures the same size as the missing capstone from the top of the pyramid in Giza over there, Khufu's pyramid. George Wiley Paul Hunt from Huntsville, Missouri, came out here, seven-term governor of Arizona, state of Arizona, as well as, I believe, the territorial governor as well for a while. He came out here and he was a whirlwind. He was a badass. They called him the walrus. He was liberal. I mean that in the Jeffersonian term liberal. He was a true liberal thinker, progressive with women's rights and voting and all that stuff. But he was a bona fite 32nd degree Scottish Rite Freemason, and he was all over the state of Arizona. He was a self-made man. If you get into his history, tough as nails, kind of a up by the bootstrap kind of guy, educated himself. And if you go to Papago Park, right next to Tempe, Arizona, named after, you know, the Vale of Tempe in Greece, you will go a place called the Hole in the Rock. That's a park there at Papago Park. And near this ancient Hohokam archaeoastronomical calendar, which is just off to the north of the pyramid, you will find Hunt's tomb. And seven people are buried in that tomb with him. And it looks identical to the pyramid on the back of the $1 bill. In fact, it is the same angle. I just went up there this week to do some more research on it. I took measurements, and it is the same angle as the pyramid on the back of the $1 bill. That, of course, gets into the latitudes and the lines and sacred geometry with the 72 squares, you know, bricks that are in that. It is Masonic all the way. And what's really frustrating as a researcher here, you can go there and hear the rangers and the park rangers say, oh, he was just a quirky Arizona guy. And all this Egyptian stuff, all this Freemasonry, all this ancient occultic symbolism embedded into our very fabric of Arizona is dismissed every time as some quirky Western caricature, you know. Mm-hmm. It's frustrating. It really is. But it's there for the whole world to see. It is white in color. It has 4-inch by 4-inch white tiles. Interestingly enough, the Egyptians, of course, covered their pyramids with that white limestone. You can see it up to 25 to 40 miles away. It's been reported. Governor Hunt covered his pyramid with white tiles. And the ancient Hohokam, which we just talked about, those 48 platform mounds, they believe they covered with a caliche, which is a white clay about 3 feet under the valley floor in Phoenix. And it's the remnant of an ancient ocean that was here years ago, the Western Interior Sea. It's really thick and it's hard to manipulate and move, but we know that they covered their platform mounds with this white clay as well to make it visible. So we have a lot of symbology going on here with tying together ancient Egypt with the modern day Phoenix, with the ancient Hohokam who lived in this valley. Once again, not just the pyramid itself, but the pyramid is three levels high. There's three main levels, including the stone pad it sits on. And that is the 3 degrees of Freemasonry, you know, the entered apprentice, the fellow craft, and the master mason. When you look at it from the air on Google Earth, it looks like steps. There's three steps as well. So this has truly been built in three dimensions on top of an ancient Hohokam PowerPoint, utilizing that ancient earth magic, that ancient earth energy.
Right. And that was going to be one of my questions for you. I had pulled a lengthy paragraph off your website that you pretty much gave us all the good stuff out of. You're clearly recognizing some important details, but I'm interested in this ancient earth magic and the Hohokam. You write that it was astrological magic, and I'm just curious if you can elaborate on what you think the ancients were doing exactly magic-wise. Because I see the attraction to some of these energy points, I see the smoke, but I don't understand the fire fully. There seems to be differing opinions out there, or at least some holes in the full picture. Can you tell us anything more?
Being a tour guide, I spent a lot of time in Sedona, and I understand the theories about the earth energy and the ley lines, the dragon lines. I have Navajo friends and Native American friends that talk about this roundabout, but I don't pretend to understand exactly how it works, other than that there are points on the earth, obviously, that these sacred sites line up with. You can go to all the ancient megalithic sites, and there's, of course, video after video of other people's research,
right,
from Peru to Egypt to Turkey, all over. And these sites are always there. When the Muslims come in and conquer the Christians, they'll tear down a church and build it right on top of that church. When the Christians go in and take over the pagans, they'll build their churches right on top of that. As the same thing with this continent. I don't believe that the European colonization of America was the first time other people were over here. It's obvious beyond the pale to me that we have been here over and over and over again. How many times? Who knows? But we know in about 10,000 years, everything goes back to dirt. Rust dissolves. It's gone. You don't even know that it was there, except for the mines, the ancient mines, right? The pyramids, things built out of stone. That stuff sticks around.
Right.
And that's what we're finding across this country and Arizona today. You know, I worked at the Grand Canyon for a year, and they find stuff in the Grand Canyon all the time.
Uh-huh. Yes, they do.
But as far as Hunt goes, as far as the tomb goes, I've been going through the actual Phoenix itself, and there are PowerPoints and there are buildings of significance at certain locations in the Phoenix Valley. We can get into all that later if you want as well. But this Papago Park is definitely a PowerPoint. The military has an underground base right there. I don't know if you know that or not.
Didn't know that.
Yeah, on the west side of this park, it's bedrock. It's really hard conglomerate rock, and they go straight down. And a buddy of mine was a contractor there. He says it goes down 7 or 8 levels. And no one really in Phoenix knows that. But yeah, why is the military there doing what they're doing? Is it just a hardened location? I don't know. But I can't find anything else about that. It's mum's the word on that, you know?
Right. And there are just so many interesting little bullet points and red flags you can point to that there's just something in the periphery here in Phoenix that a lot of people seem to know about, but it's under wraps, it's in the shadows, and you probably have to be initiated to really get a handle on exactly why it's important and what those ancients were doing. I mean, obviously, that's a big question. I can't expect you to know, but I definitely noticed those same patterns of rebuilding on the Earth's energy grid and just a certain, like, even military bases internationally, we're told, are usually about controlling these places, banks, churches.
Yes.
Everything they can do. And let me ask you, I guess, a little more practical question that I've heard you talk about that I also just think is quite interesting. I never really thought about it much, but you've written about the natural environment in Arizona itself and how similar it is to places where civilizations tend to develop. Why is this template of a dry desert with a river running through it so typical for civilizations as a starting place, as opposed to areas that are more lush.
Yeah, this occurred to me after my probably 400th tour down here, given Sonoran Desert ethnobotanical tours. And it really occurred to me one day, these people were thriving. These ancient Hohokam were thriving. First of all, there are six rivers that meet in Phoenix, right? We have the Gila River, the Salt River, the Verde, New River, Agua Fria, and the Haciempa. Some of those meet the other rivers, but they meet at a place called Tres Rios, which is about 7 miles west of downtown Phoenix. So imagine hundreds of years ago, six riparian, lush water systems flowing in from three directions into the valley where it gently rolls through and can be irrigated and farmed. Those were highways back in the day, going out to the Great Plains of New Mexico, up to the Anasazi culture in the Four Corners area, to all the Sinaguan, Agua Frian, Mugian, Salado cultures to the north, all the way up to the Grand Canyon, and then the Patayan culture in the Colorado Plateau to the west. Everything and anything flooding from anywhere in America down had to come through Phoenix. Anything from the Yucatan up had to come right through Phoenix. And it's evident from these canal systems, the amount of labor and time would have taken to have dug them, that people have been here for a long time, probably the beginning. We look over to the Middle East. You have Iraq. You have Afghanistan, Pakistan, right? These deserts where we know that civilization started. Maybe not humanity, but civilization, definitely. The first recorded civilization was Sumer, and that is modern-day Baghdad. And it's because, in my opinion, that it is a desert. You have a hot, dry climate with perennial water sources coming through. This allows for 3 to 4 planting seasons per year, especially if you have good grain like corn. You can get two plantings of that, then your tubers, right, in the fall, if you've ever gardened, and your spring greens and your fall greens, you can farm. As the water comes in and floods your rivers, like the Nile, it redeposits more nutrients, right? And then it goes back down again. So you have a cycle. There are no tropical diseases because you're not in the jungle.
Right.
So you don't have to fight that. Life is a little tougher in certain ways. And we see a lot of violence coming out of jungle cultures, right? All the way around the world, no matter what continent you're on. And they say it's because, the anthropologists say it's because life is easier. So people, you know, idle hand, the devil's work. They spend a lot of time fighting instead of surviving. And they put all their energy to that and they just develop violent cultures. Well, you don't see a lot of violent cultures developing in desert cultures. And because of that, you have more cooperative cultures like the Hopi, like the ancient Arab cultures. And you have no snow. You have no downtime. You don't have to plan and sit around for 6 months, you know? You can keep working. This allows for more food. This allows for more time. Then you start developing technologies and more religion and ideas and kind of just gets a jump start on civilization. I don't think it's a coincidence that we see these ancient technology in the canals and the platform mounds here in Phoenix that we see in the Middle East.
Yeah, man. I just thought a lot of that was really fascinating because I never thought about it much either, especially the point you just made about the scale of violence in jungle cultures versus something like ancient Egypt or these places that are more desert-like. Mm-hmm. I mean, I definitely think there's a link between place and psyche, that we are as much a part of our environment as our environment's a part of us. And I don't know, there's something there, but just the idea of there being less disease, milder winter, fewer dangerous animals, or at least better visibility,
yeah,
river travel for trade.
Trade.
I think those are just great points. And it's weird to think about Arizona in that context of being a match for all that. And then, you know, you get into reading between the lines of its history, and maybe there's been multiple cultural layers, some of them obviously suppressed. And it all just forms a pretty interesting picture of the area when we generally write off the Southwest. You know, we don't think about the American Southwest generally as all that interesting, but definitely seems to be.
No, and I'll tell you what I tell people when I take them out into the desert on tour. We think of America starting with, you know, the old West starting with the cowboys, but it didn't. Going backwards, we had the Americans, right? And then we had the Mexicans prior to that, because it's all Mexico. And then it was España Nueva or New Spain, right? Prior to that, it was Pimeria Alta, which was the Pima Empire. Prior to that, it was the Hohokam for 1,600 years. Prior to that, it was the archaic cultures and the basket weaving cultures. We know prior to that, it was the Clovis cultures. That's about as far as we can really find stuff going back on. But when you get into the stories of Atlantis and Plato and Aristotle, they talk about faraway lands. When you talk about more modern, like the Ming dynasty, right? Ming sent out the Starfleet and he sent, what, 300 ships forward? I believe, and two didn't come back for about 5 years. They finally came back and said, we discovered this great, huge land off to the east, and we got off the ships and went inland, and there was this huge canyon we couldn't get to the bottom of. It's massive, unfathomable. That's documented. It could only be the Grand Canyon, you know? When I spent time with a medicine man by the name of Mann, M-A-N-N, up on the Hualapai Indian Reservation years ago, I got to sit up on a mountaintop with him for about 8 hours and just listen to him. And he said that he was hunting bears, a boy, sometime in the 1930s. And he was down them canyons. It's a tributary coming into the Grand Canyon. He said he took refuge in a cave and he began finding symbols, didn't know what they were. Years later, he found out they were Chinese. He went back and wrote them all down. And there's ancient Chinese written in these cave systems all through the Grand Canyon. He says, we all know about them. They're all there. He says, Chinese were here prior to the Americans, prior to the Spanish, without a doubt. He speaks with matter-of-factly. I think people have been coming here for a long time.
Well, not only just coming there, but making your way to some remote natural beauty and then feeling the need to carve something in it is a very human thing to do if you've ever been anywhere remote or unique. Kind of a sad thing, really, but at least in this context, it's a clue to the truth. And the fact that someone would do that at any time depth is very easy for me to believe. It just makes sense.
Yeah, when you go through and you kind of study European colonization, we're all taught in school that they thought the world was flat, right? And they took a big chance coming over here. BS, you know, absolute BS. The Moors knew that it was round. They knew it was over here. Ponce de Leon sailed with the Moors, and he knew that there was a spring over here. We'll get into that later. But everyone knew, the Chinese knew that the earth was round and they came over. And sorry to you flat earthers out there. I do respect your opinion. You have great arguments, by the way. But
well, that's something.
Yeah. When we came over here, I have a sneaky suspicion that these ancient societies and the monarchy knew. They knew monarchy was changing and the next phase was being laid out. They got here first. They staked their claim and they made their Western expansion and claimed all this territory from Arizona. I mean, all of it. The whole entire country was taken by Masons. I don't know if you know this, but everyone who died at the Alamo, they're all Freemasons.
No.
They found Billy the Kid's apron a couple years back. Pat Garrett was a Mason. All these Western men were Masons. They all came out. Buffalo Bill Cody was a Mason. The history of the Southwest and Masonry. And further to my point, the conquering and the acquisition and managing of the resources. And that's what this is all about. It's the control of the resources. And that's where my research ties into all this ancient history. They're still here in Phoenix and they're laying out their fingerprints all over. And they manage the insurance companies and they manage the water, SRP, the Salt River Project, and the Colorado River Pact, because water is life out here. They manage the politics, all of it, the direction, where the new highways are going to go, all these PowerPoints, and they put their little shrines up everywhere they can to mark their territory, right out in the open for those who have the eyes to see.
Yeah.
And it's all over.
Absolutely. Resource management, something we take for granted because we get water piped into our house, so we just don't really think about it all that much. But I live in San Diego where they're fining people for watering their lawn. Meanwhile, I drive down the highway and I see just these massive big agri farms where they're just watering dirt or it's watering the highway road. Like they're wasting gallons. And so it's all about, well, you regular people need to conserve, but we can't even touch the waste that agricultural corporations are doing. And of course, they get a free pass. So it's just an interesting little side note. But this is really awesome, man. I'm sure you have just many, many personal anecdotes that are fascinating to someone like me. And to switch gears just a bit, I like this one section of your bio where you say, for a while, you rode for a local ranch working cattle the old way and teamed up with an old prospector to explore the surrounding mountains and valleys. Many afternoons were spent in trading posts listening to firsthand accounts of ruins, lost mines, secret springs, and the caves deep in the desert. You then headed into the desert and found those places and more. I mean, Wow, man. I'm always particularly interested in stories of caves and underground cities, and they pop up all over the Southwest. There's a pretty famous Fortean story of finding the ruins of an ancient underground city of giants in Death Valley, for example.
Sure.
But I'm curious what you could tell us about lost mines or caves in that area that you find most interesting or have tried to find yourself.
So when I was living in Wikiup at 18, I met up with an old prospector by the name of Jim Miller. I mean, he was just a modern day shady pirate of a guy. You know, that proverbial man with the pickaxe and the mule wandering out of the desert.
Yeah,
that was this dude. He had a limp. If he had a patch, it'd be pretty. He did have a fake eye. So, you know, this was him. And we just clicked. He was a cool cat. He was into prospecting. He knew Carlos Castaneda from California. He'd known him for 10 years and worked with him over there. So he had all these crazy stories. And for an 18-year-old boy, that was awesome. I was studying botany at the time, and he was into prospecting. He had a perpetual gold fever. So we teamed up, and I would go help him find mineral in the desert because certain plants grow where certain minerals are heavier, right? You know, copper, you're going to find more junipers. You're going to find Ocotillo cactus over limestone deposits, which is indicative of caves, on and on and on. So we teamed up doing all that. There were some cowboys, old Mexican cowboys have been up in that area forever. And they'd tell me about these pots back in the desert where these caves and cavettes. And I went back there. We found these Indian burial grounds. We found places where people don't go. People think that everything's been found out here in the desert. You know, Greg, if you think about it, probably, oh, what percentage of people do you say get out here and walk around in the Arizona Southwest in the backcountry?
Oh, man. Almost none, because I just recently drove to and from Vegas, and I know it's obviously not the same, but everywhere you look, you just think, go 500 feet off this road, and who knows the last time a person actually stood there.
Right.
We just drive on these two-lane highways. Yeah. We don't ever walk out even 100 feet from that road.
Yeah, I'd say probably 20, 30% of the U.S. population is healthy enough to go backpacking in this off-trail, no-trail, rugged stuff. Out of them, probably 2% have the inclination to do so. And out of them, probably almost none of them know what they're looking at once they get out there, because they're just out there for recreation, you know, watching the birds and, you know, the rocks. They're not looking for ruin systems or ancient markings or how it all plays in line with the ancient history and the patterns of migration. So if you go out there looking for the right things, you're going to find stuff. It's out there right now, just laying there waiting for someone to connect those dots. Cortez came up through the Big Sandy Valley. That's where Wikiup's at. A friend of mine showed me years ago, Jimmy. I'm not going to give his last name. I don't want his family harassed. But he pulled out these beads, and he showed me these strings of beads that he had, and they were a hardened clay. And here's where we go down the rabbit hole, partner.
Yeah.
I saw these beads firsthand. I touched them. I looked at them for a couple hours while we made biscuits and bacon and sat there and talked. Come to find out later, he dies. And I tried to track these beads down last year. And I talked to his buddy, and I get a hold of him. He says, yeah, man, you know, we didn't know about those beads. He'd found them in a cave about 12 miles north of Wikiup, off to the side of the highway there. He said he found them in the 1970s, and they had these little etchings all around them. They weren't smooth. They had etchings. We didn't know what the writing were. That's why he had showed me, because he knew that I studied ancient cultures at that time. Come to find out, they took them to an expert, and they were Polynesian.
Wow.
Polynesian. That's what the guy told him. He says, these are without a doubt Polynesian. Now, back in the late 70s, he had contacted the Smithsonian Institute and told them that he had them, and he had mailed them over there. He got a phone call about 2 weeks later saying, you got any more of these? He's like, nope. You know, of course, he had hundreds more. He said, what is it? They said, well, we don't know yet, but we're just going to hang on to these. If you find any more, you let us know. We're just going to keep these. So they wouldn't even give them back. They wouldn't tell them. But they were Polynesian. When they took them in again, the guy looked into the grooves in the clay, and they found micro etchings in the groove.
Wow.
Of this Polynesian language. Yeah, and that's one thing that we find up there in Wikiup. You know, men have their proverbial man caves. I have a cave. You know, I go to my cave up there, and it's got a spring in the back of it. No one ever goes back there. I got some initials from old cowboy from the 1920s, I think, on the wall. But it's an ancient Patayan migration camp when they came through from the Colorado Delta up to the Prescott area. You know, I know what it is. I haven't dug down, but it's there. There's stuff all through there, and it's amazing. I discovered a couple years ago some pictographs on the ceiling of a cave not far from Wikiup. And I took the photos to an expert on pictographs and petroglyphs of specifically Arizona cultures, and he could not contain himself, wanted me to take him out there. He's written 3 books on, you know, this stuff, but we could never come to an agreement as to naming rights or anything else. He just wanted to grab the glory of it. And I'm working on a deal to take an expedition out there currently. But he says they're more than likely Patayan. And if they are, they're the only ones in existence. So there's stuff out there, man, all over the desert. I'm encouraging anyone listening to this, go on Google Earth, go 50-mile radius of your home and start exploring. You're going to find stuff, man.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
I'm with you. And I absolutely used to have this attitude that everything's been discovered and there's no great mysteries. And that is so, so untrue. And nobody's spotlight is on ancient American cultures for the most part. I think there's malls built right next to mounds and all kinds of crazy stuff. Like, we've probably covered a lot of it, but I think there's still a lot out there all across America.
Yeah, without a doubt. Without a doubt, there is. You know, it's like when we gave that worthless strip of land to the Navajos years and years ago. Then they find out there's uranium and coal under it, right? Not so worthless anymore. Now, what are we going to discover 100 years from now when we have equipment to tap into dark matter or energy where there's forces around us at these energy spots that are going to be revalued? You know, that's what I think about when I walk by these ancient sites.
Right. So let me ask you about these stories of ancient giants or this this cannibalistic tribe of red-haired giants that some Native American tribes have legends of. Do you think there is truth to that? Again, the Smithsonian comes up in those stories, not returning the bones that were sent to them. So that was kind of a interesting correlation there. But what are your thoughts on those stories?
So giants are one of my favorite topics. Of course, I'll never be a Stephen Quayle. He writes amazing information about it, but not all of it. There's a lot of it he misses because he can't, you know, get to everything. I've asked every one of my Native American friends, Apaches, Hopi, Navajo, Paiute, every one of them without fail talk about giants. Not only the fact that they were cannibals and hunted humans, but that sometimes they came from those giants as well. And it is ubiquitous. Just like Genesis 6:4 talks about the creation story, those giants are always tied to a flood story. There's a story I wrote about Ho'ok, H-O-apostrophe-O-K, down here on the Gila River with the Gila people. There's Keho, which is a modern day story of a so-called alleged giant around the Hoover Dam that they found the bones, right? Sometime in, I believe, the 50s. There's the red-haired giants up in the Lovelock Cave in Nevada. The Navajos have the stories of the twin giants, right? Of the giants and the twins that kill them. The Apaches call the giants the Gwindipids, and they lived in the Superstition Mountains just east of Phoenix, Arizona. In fact, if you ever come to the valley and you go out towards Apache Junction into the Superstitions, you'll see all these rock spires coming up on the west side. Well, they believe that those are the giants that got caught by the water, couldn't get up, and they turned to stone, which kind of ties into the story of Lot with Sodom and Gomorrah when his wife turns around and turns to a pillar of ash or a salt pillar. You see these congruences and these metaphors through these ancient Native American stories and the biblical ones. And the biblical one is the one that, you know, being a European, I know those stories. I'm sure they go into all the other creation stories as well. We know that the Vedics talk about them in India, right? Ancient Ireland, the Gaelics, the pagans talk about it. Ancient England has stories of giants. It's just ubiquitous. And here in the Southwest, it's no different. A couple commonalities between all these stories is that there's a woman who goes off on her own and she's forced or raped in the desert and comes back. And 9 months later gives birth to a large child. I'll just kind of retell the story of Ho'ok for you here.
Sure.
This takes place not far from Santan, which is kind of its own town, but it can be considered a suburb of Phoenix off to the southeast. The Santan Mountains and the Gila Indian tribe out there. A woman goes out, gets violated, gives birth to a girl, and the girl is big, and she bites a lot, and she's violent and cries a lot. And as she grows older, you know, she starts developing these paws, like feet, like paws of a dog or an animal, and she has claws on her hand, not nails. and the other boys won't play with her and the girls won't play with her. So she joins the hunting parties with the men, and she hunts with the men for a couple years. And after a while, the men are like, damn, she's mean. You know, she's like chasing down rabbits and ripping them apart with her teeth. And she's fighting with the men, and she killed a man once, and no more. She ain't allowed to hunt with us anymore. She's out of control. So they kick her out of the tribe, and she goes to live in a cave in the Santan Mountains. I know right where the cave's at. I haven't been there yet because it's on the Indian res, and I don't know any Gila natives to take me out there. But it's there, and there's a big effigy, by the way, made in rocks at the base of this cave, and that's for her. It's still there today, this big rock design at the bottom of this cave. It's still out there. But she goes to live in this cave, and then they notice, you know, months later that all the deer are disappearing. And then the children start disappearing. Mm-hmm. And they realize that she has this insatiable appetite and hunger. And they know what's going on. So they go to the medicine man and say, what are we going to do? And they say, well, let's throw a big party for her. And we have to kill her somehow. So let's get her drunk. So anyway, the story goes on. But they bring her to the festival. And for 4 days, they give her alcohol, fermented cactus fruit wine. And they dance, and they make her exhausted, and they carry her back to her cave, and they stick her in this cave, and they pile it up with mesquite and wood, and they light it on fire, and she screams as she's dying, and she's dead. The story goes on from there that her spirit comes out of her body and cracks the top of the cave, and there is a crack in the rock right there, and it shoots into a bird, and the bird comes down and lands in a pot of beans, and some medicine man eats the beans. So it's possession. The story goes on to possession, and they have to go to the top of South Mountain in South Phoenix and get a medicine man to come down, because that's where the medicine men live, and South Mountain's its own thing as well. But they eventually get rid of the spirit of Ho'oak, and she no longer torments them. It's kind of crazy, but if you start studying Native American stories, mythology, you know where the lines are drawn between the morals, right, and the actual event, kind of like the Bible with the parables and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. I love those kind of stories, and I just love the tales of giants. It seems so far-fetched, but I think there's enough there to, you know, put it in the true column. And I took a research tour of Armenia with Graham Hancock a couple of years ago. It was like 2 weeks, and the local researchers would talk about giants and places where bones were found, and Graham would roll his eyes and say he wasn't interested in those giant stories, didn't believe them.
Really?
And I would always pry a little bit more. I'd be like, you know, I'd get the translator, hey, can you ask Vazkin a little more about that giant thing? Like, and I'd get a few more sentences. And I just love to throw that out there because these local Armenian researchers have almost zero reach, but they also have a lot of fascinating stuff they found in the area. But to go back to that section of your bio that I read, in that paragraph, you mention Secret Springs, and I'm curious if this is a reference to Castle Hot Springs or something else.
No, there's other springs out there on maps. And you have to keep in mind that I've walked and backpacked miles and miles and miles of desert, and there's something mystical and literally spiritual and sacred about water in the desert. There are springs that are not on maps out there, Secret Springs, that are coming out of an old pipe, you know, that some cowboy stuck in the ground, or that are underground and don't surface, and you can go under these caves and find them. There are secret springs in the desert, and that's what I was talking about. There was a half-breed, Eddie Benegas, half-Mexican cowboy out there. Back then, I used to brew beer, and he was a bit of a imbiber. He would come over, and I would give him my homebrew, and he would tell me these ancient stories and all the secrets of the desert out there.
Oh,
it was a pretty good arrangement.
Yeah.
It was great. And he told me, he said, get your maps out. And we'd sit there and have a couple of brews, and he would tell me where these ancient places were. I was lucky. I was lucky to have him there. But yeah, they're out there. Castle Hot Springs is another story.
Yes.
It's at the base of the Bradshaw Mountains. It is the first territorial capital of Arizona before it started rolling around. It's a very powerful spot. It's known as the healing springs to the Yavapai as well as the Apache. Even in times of war, people were granted pass to go in there. In more modern day times, when the colonization happened, the governors and the wealthy, the Carnegies, the Rockefellers would come to Arizona. They would hang out there in these springs. Later on, JFK came there and he healed up, right? Lots of famous people, wealthy people, have come from around the world to sit in these springs. Castle Hot Springs is known as the deepest rock water in Arizona that we know of. It's at least 7,000 feet deep. It comes out, I want to say it's I can't remember, I wrote the article years ago, but it was like 120 degrees, I think.
Right.
And there's three pools and each pool is a little bit cooler. They had built the capital of Arizona right there. And when the train came through Wickenburg, there was a stagecoach that would run up there into those mountains to where that was. They used to hang people from the front steps of this territorial capital. Mm-hmm. It was the governor's office and it was the hanging tree and it was the whole, you know, business. It was everything. It was kind of a cool little piece of history. It was bought out by a number of different people through the years. Arizona State University bought it. And as of last year, I think it just changed hands again. I haven't looked at who's got it, but they're talking of opening it back up for memberships and to go in there and sit in the springs and heal. So this caught my attention because I had been studying the ancient colonization of our country and Ponce de Leon, right? And the Fountain of Youth. Well, this also ties into a guy who was doing a lot of work here in the 70s on the monoatomic gold.
Yeah.
Have you heard of? Well, that whole thing started right here in Phoenix. He was a farmer to the southwest, and he was trying to figure out how to chemically get rid of the alkalinity in his soil. He's pouring chemicals on his soil, and he takes in the soil to get assay, and he finds this new element, right? It intrigues him. He spends hundreds of thousands of dollars, and he buys a spectrometer and discovers a new element, what he calls monoatomic gold. When he hits it at a certain frequency for the burn-off, it leaves the dimension, it disappears completely, then it reappears again. Well, while this is happening, he's patenting it, he's forming his own, dare I say, religion. But he's still out there. You can look up monoatomic gold and get into all the research yourself. It's quite copious. It's exhaustive, to tell you the truth. But what he's saying is that this monoatomic gold is what bridges the synapses in the brain, kind of like spice on that movie Dune. You remember the old sci-fi Dune?
Yes. Yeah.
Basically, it's just like spice, and that the natives would eat it, the medicine men would eat it. He's harkened it back to ancient Egypt with Moses and Mount Sinai, and that they used to manufacture it there. Well, I met a guy in Florida who said, yeah, well, the Fountain of Youth down here in Florida, what it is you have this gold washing off of the mainland. It hits the limestone bed and it goes down deep in those caverns and it becomes pressurized. So all this heavy metal sinks way, 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 way down there. And you have the nutritious salts coming in off the ocean and all this cocktail getting pressurized underground for who knows how long and then coming up in an artesian spring. So a natural engine or a natural foundry, if you will, that creates this monoatomic gold underground through the salts and the limestone, the nutritious soils, the heat and the pressure, and then coming up through an artesian spring. Well, to tie this back to Arizona here, the Bradshaw Mountains are the most mineralized mountain range in the United States of America, it's been told. There's more heavy metals, gold, silver, and other heavy metals around that mountain than anywhere else, the concentration. Only it's not concentrated enough to actually dig it out. It's all spread out. Well, if you have on the southern end of that, right at the bottom of that drainage, a spring coming up, what's the chances of those heavy metals going down and pressurizing 7,000 feet and coming up? We know there's a healing spring there that's been revered by all Native Americans in ancient times. We know that the wealthy and the elite came here, and the first thing they did in Arizona was build a territorial capital on the spring. There's something to it. You know, I'm convinced.
Mm-hmm.
Money and wealth and power does not gravitate arbitrarily. They seek out power and they take the good stuff. And if they came right here when they first got to Arizona, there's a reason for it. You know, we wouldn't know until 1970s about the monoatomic gold, but I think that's the science underneath it. And that's for someone else to go through and figure out. I can't be an expert in everything, but I can connect enough dots to tell you there's something there.
Absolutely, man. We have talked on the show about alchemy and the idea of ormus. I think that's another term people use for this stuff. And you mentioned that popping into another dimension, that's exactly how they describe this stuff.
Yep.
There's a documentary out there called All the Gold You Can Eat, where a guy talks to five or six different older gentlemen who have spent their lives keeping this secret or working on this in secret. And it's fascinating. I mean, there's even some suggestion that the large corporations know this stuff and they have highly guarded secret bunkers where they're actually making the things that they're saying are artificially scarce. I mean, who knows? You can imagine that that would just be something that would be one of the biggest secrets you'd want to keep. And in terms of water, yeah, I absolutely think water has healing properties in certain conditions. Maybe natural sites did give ancient people insight into this, and there's techniques probably to amplify it further. It's no surprise that our modern water supply is such shit quality, and this information is so suppressed. And as a side note, this was something that I thought was pretty damn interesting, too, from your article about Castle Hot Springs. David Copperfield has claimed to have discovered a fountain of youth on one of his 11 islands purchased in 2006 for $50 million. To quote Mr. Copperfield, "I've discovered a true phenomenon. You can take dead leaves, they come in contact with the water and become full of life again. Mm-hmm. Bugs or insects that are near death come in contact with the water and they'll fly away. It's an amazing thing. Very, very exciting." He also states, "We found this liquid that in its simple stages can actually do miraculous things. Brown leaves turn green. It is natural. Simple organisms that are near death are rejuvenated. So we don't know about the effects on humans, but we're doing research and development." I mean, that sounds like this kind of monoatomic gold ormus fluid. I mean, it all ties into ether physics, and this all this stuff, I think, is suppressed and also synergistic, like you mentioned earlier.
It all ties in together. And to point out, David Copperfield's islands aren't that far from Florida. It's right there, right? It's right off the coast there. It's like I said early on, everything eventually ties in together at some point. It's really hard to stay on topic when you talk about this stuff because the giants go into the monoatomic, which goes, it all ties together. So,
no, it's fascinating. It's really amazing stuff. And to talk about another ancient site that's somewhat of a mystery, we've all probably heard about the Nazca lines, these giant animals and humanoid figure outlines that were made to be seen from the sky, which begs the question, why would a civilization hundreds or thousands of years before conventional air travel put so much energy into building things you can only see from the sky? Well, Arizona actually has a site that's quite similar, doesn't it?
It does. They're called the Blythe Intaglios. So that's the name for them. They're right outside of Blythe, California, on the California side there. But there are several of them along the Gila River all the way into the Phoenix area, if you know where to look. They don't like talking about them. The archaeologists don't want people out there messing with them. They're made the exact same way. There is a tarnished patina rock on the desert floor that's just been baked there for millions of years. And they moved that rock aside and uncovered the lighter rock underneath it. And these designs that whomever made, we don't know who made them, are a horse or dog-like creature. There's one of a woman with really, really long arms. There's another one of someone spearing a fish. And there's other ones there as well. There's also the one, like I mentioned just a minute ago, with Ho'oak. The rocks are laid out. There's some, if I understand, along the Gila River, not far from Gila Bend, out in the desert along the river as well. So they're all out there. To me, it would make sense that the Nazcas, or maybe someone who was there with them, migrated up. They're nowhere near as big and as perfect and intricate as the ones in Nazca, but they are here. It's kind of like it would be to the Nazca lines what the later pyramids were in Egypt to the Great Pyramid, right? They just weren't quite as awesome.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They came after, no doubt. But yeah, they're here.
I saw the pictures that you put up of them. They're pretty impressive. I mean, a lot of people probably see these Nazca lines on TV and they're like, man, I wish I could go there. Meanwhile, you're probably just a few states over from something very, very similar. It's just not on television. So you didn't know about it. It's just kind of crazy.
Yeah. You know, and they'd gone through and they asked these natives, they said, so why did you guys build this? And that's Mojave country. And they're like, we didn't make it. They were here when we got here.
Oh,
you know,
I love that kind of stuff. You know, I've asked a lot of guests about insight from Native American tribes because it is so kept close to the chest for them. They don't really give a lot of the secrets out. And why would they? You know,
yeah.
You know, we don't really deserve them in a lot of cases. But there are people like yourself who do make friends with them and sometimes get great insight from them when they open up a little bit. I'm just curious, broadly speaking, if you could talk to us a little bit more about that kind of thing, because it's just like, where else are we going to learn this stuff?
Yeah. When you're talking with natives, First of all, they're like everyone else. They're just human. They're just people.
Right.
They know what they know. Europeans especially have some, they think they're like magical creatures or something. No, they're thin-skinned mammals with opposable thumbs, just like us. And they have cell phones and drive Chevy trucks. But they have something else. They have an ancient history that they don't want to be corrupted.
Right.
You know, when I talk to my Apache friend, Albert, he's full-blooded Mescalera. He'll tell me stories of, you know, what his grandfather told him. But they only know what they know. Some natives are more willing to talk about this stuff. Others aren't. I've written a ton about skinwalkers, and I have a gentleman I've been in touch with from the res, and he's open about skinwalkers. One of the only natives I've ever known who is. Most of them will not. It's just, you got to be courteous, and you have to know when to stop asking questions, and you have to ask a question a certain way without being intrusive. And it's just respect and politeness. But if you let them tell you what they want to tell you, and if you know how to listen, you'll really start picking stuff up. If that makes any sense.
It does.
You know, I have a really good friend who's half Paiute. I grew up with in Wikiup, and we did a lot of hunting together. And he taught me, you know, he told me a little bit more than the average person, than he would anyone else. When I was at the Grand Canyon, I guided with a Hopi. We lived in the same home for about a year. We were bunk mates right next door. So we would, you know, grab a bottle of wine and we'd all sit there and talk to him. And of course, we're all interested in what he had to say. And he would just weave the stories and the tales of his people. He was Coyote Clan. So he was a warrior. He was in the Marine Corps. You know, he ties his ancient duty as the Coyote Clan into the modern day life. So he went to the Marines and he went into battle and came back. And he's now a guide at the Grand Canyon. They will tell you all kinds of really cool stuff. And if you ask, you know, if they can tell you, they will. If they say, I don't want to talk about that, okay, it's cool. You don't. But they generally won't volunteer a lot of information. And they themselves don't put it into a context that you and I are discussing now. They might know the story, right? But they don't know what it means in relation to the ancient Bible or the metaphysics that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they don't have all the pieces either.
Well, yeah, it's just still fascinating. And I did want to try to touch on the Grand Canyon a bit. You could really build a whole show around the rumors and mysteries there. But
oh, we could do a series on the,
But, you know, those legends of an ancient civilization being there, artifacts, mysterious tunnels, etc. They're always swarming around. What can you share with us about the Grand Canyon that you think is not so well known, but also fascinating?
Where do I begin? It is 277 miles long, 1 mile deep, and on the average 10 miles wide. The tributary canyons dumping into it from the north are the least explored territory left in the United States of America. You can look back 750,000 years of time looking down into it. And it's one of the deepest, it's one of the only places in the world where you can access openly exposed rock, the Vishnu schist down there in the bottom of it. It's geologically, historically, militarily, an awesome place. I mean, what direction you want to go? It's a natural fortress. Of course, when you get into the occult and the mysteries of Arizona, you get into G.E. Kincaid and the supposed lost Egyptian. People say Egyptian civilization. I don't think it's Egyptian. I know I wrote an article about that, one of my first articles years ago. I am going to write follow-up material on this. I believe there was a civilization in the Grand Canyon at one point, probably many, more than likely Chinese at this point. I've been working with a guy out of Utah, Dan, and he believes it to be Greco-Roman. He thinks the canal systems in Phoenix were engineered by Greco-Romans. We know the Minoans were in the Midwest, but back to, I'm not getting off track here like I do. The Grand Canyon, I worked there for a year and almost nobody knows the Grand Canyon mystery. No one knows about G.E. Kincaid. People just go there. It's like any other job. They just do their job. The guides kind of are interested a little bit more in that stuff and they'll go down the rabbit holes, but they're working. They're not studying the stuff at night. You know, they're having a beer with their buddies. When you live at the Grand Canyon, it truly is an amazing place. The people that have lived there, of course, the Navajo live next to it. They don't live in there. The Havasupai have lived down in the bottom. The Hopi traveled through there when they made their migration up, either from what's now Guatemala, or if you believe literally their creation story, the Sipapu, the place of emergence right there at the Little Colorado and Big Colorado confluence. So you got all of that overlaying it. But you got the modern day mysteries of what it is. And it is a national park. If you take the Smoky Mountains out due to their geography, the Grand Canyon is the most visited park in the United States of America. That being said, Only 5% of people who visit that park actually go down below the rim and walk down onto the trails. Out of them, 99% of them stay on the main trail and go down to Phantom Ranch or the Bass Trail and the South Kaibab Trail, and they come up the other side, and no one goes into the interior. So even though it's an open park and it gets more visitors, they're all centralized in that little strip of land right there on the southern end. No one goes into it. No one goes down there. Probably the river rafting guides more than anybody, but when they're down there, they don't hike up those canyons. You can't access those canyons. To give you an idea of how big, and when I say the Grand Canyon, I mean the canyon itself and all the tributary canyons north and south up into southern Utah, okay, and even down into Arizona. They found a pictograph panel back in, I want to say 1983, 1984, called Gordon's Panel or the Shaman's Wall. Just sitting in the open right there in this canyon waiting to be discovered. It's the oldest known pictographs ever discovered on this continent, and they were just discovered in 1984.
Hmm.
That's how desolate and rural this area is. It's a 50-mile 4x4 ride in there. It's a 3-mile hike down a trail if you can find it, and you got to find this rock outcropping. There's stuff all over that. My Hopi friends, my Wallapai friends, they say there's stuff in those canyons you guys don't even know about. There's cliff dwellings. There's ruins. There's stuff in there that you're never going to see that our elders tell us about.
Wow.
And I get the feeling it's been blocked off by the government through the Park Service. I have research I've been working on, and I wish I could finish it. It just keeps getting bigger and bigger, that all of these national parks that we have are surprisingly in very mysterious places where very mysterious things transpire.
Yeah.
Whether it's the disappearances, what's that gentleman doing all that work, missing 411 recently,
David,
right?
David Politis, yeah.
Yeah, those are all national parks, right? If you want to block off a bunch of land and make it hard to access and hide your secrets, just make a park out of it. That gives you instant federal oversight, funding, jurisdiction, and enforcement.
Absolutely.
I think there's a lot more going on at the Grand Canyon than we know. And I believe it started with this G.E. Kincaid cave thing, because it ties in right at the time when the National Monument and the National Park Service fired up. For those of you who aren't following here, an article came out in the Phoenix Gazette in 1909, April 5th, stating that a cavern system was discovered in the Grand Canyon, and Orient/Egyptian-esque Buddha doll, copper weaponry, huge caverns, 50,000 people could live in there, on and on and on. It goes, you can find it. There's copious amounts of material on the internet about it. But it was shortly after that that the Grand Canyon became a national monument. And it was shortly after that it got upgraded to a national park. And they'll tell you that you can go there. Oh, you can go wherever you want in the Grand Canyon. No, you can't. Absolutely not. For one thing, the North Rim is blocked off at least 5 months out of the year. They say it's due to snow, and you cannot go up there. You cannot go wherever you want in the Grand Canyon because certain canyons are off limits to nesting birds and endangered bats, they say. I know for a fact from friends who've worked in the Grand Canyon that they have satellite-linked infrared beams going across trails, and they know when you're back in there. You won't know that you've crossed one, but they monitor that backcountry pretty heavily. They don't want people in certain places. When you call the Grand Canyon and say, hey, I want to go here, and they say, well, you need a backcountry pass, so you got to go in and talk to them, and you got to give me your whole hiking plan. They go, oh, well, you can't go there. They'll tell you that you can't. And we got some endangered bird or some condor or, you know, whatever. And it could be, but you definitely cannot go. You cannot camp at large. You can in certain places, but you just can't camp everywhere. They want you in certain campsites, which means you can only hike so far in before you got to turn around and come back to camp in that campsite. Otherwise, you're destroying. And of course, it's under the guise of environmentalism and ecology and all that stuff. And whether that's important, it's still been weaponized. And, you know, it's controlling where people go there. So, yeah, there's a lot going on up there. People don't realize when you go on vacation and stand in the Grand Canyon and look at it, there's a whole nother world just below the surface of the Grand Canyon.
Right. And I was going to bring this up exactly as you did, this whole idea of the national park designation, because you have on the website, we know there are a lot of Egyptian and Hindu god names used around the canyon. And you let us know on the site that that's Charles Dutton's doing. And
yeah.
On January 13th, 1888, 33 men got together and formed a geographical society.
Yeah.
A week later, Charles Dutton sat as the chairman of that society, and it formalized into the National Geographic Society. And then, of course, shortly after, well, we have this article in 1909, and then the Grand Canyon was designated a national monument a few years later in 1912, then a national park in 1919. And then to read from your site a little more, it says, it seems that soon after Americans first began penetrating the labyrinth of canyons beneath the rim and making discoveries, the federal government swept in, designated it a national park, and assumed legal control of everything. It was during this time that construction on the Glen Canyon and Hoover Dams began as well. I've often thought to myself, what better way to keep something hidden than to bury it under a lake? Yes, these dams are hydroelectric power generators, but could there have been another reason for their construction as well? Could they have been constructed in order to cover up extensive evidence of an ancient civilization at the bottom of the Grand Canyon? That's compelling. Those are the exact kind of questions that we like to ask around here.
I believe absolutely so. And I don't believe that was the first time that was done. That was the U.S. Reclamation Act. They came through and they built those two dams. And if there is going to be an ancient civilization in the Grand Canyon, it's not going to be in those deep, dark, unpenetrable canyons. It's going to be at the mouths of that canyon on both sides where it starts to plain out again. That's where your irrigation is going to happen. That's where your access and your ease of travel and your trade is going to take place. And right there is where those two dams are constructed. Are you familiar with the environmentalist Edward Abbey?
I am not.
Yeah, he's a Southwestern author. He's passed on now, but he wrote The Monkey Wrench Gang and Desert Solitaire, two of the greatest books out here. He wrote about that area before those dams got built, especially on the Green River, all the Native American cliff dwellings and hanging gardens and orchids that were in there. He says there was so much stuff that got buried under that. I have no doubt it was done on purpose. There's a great book, is it Secrets of the America? Secret History of the Americas. I forget the authors, but they talk about the same thing with Lewis and Clark. When they went up right there in Washington, Oregon, there was another valley that they recommended get flooded out as well. And of course, they were Masons. They were Freemasons. They were sent out by Jefferson. And Lewis, Meriwether Lewis, he was a Freemason. And back to Clarence Dutton there, you know, if anyone thinks it's just a coincidence that the American Geographical Society is formed with 33 members.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and it's fashioned identical just after the European Geographical Society, which is the same society that went out. And that's the one that you see in the beginning of Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
That's where they had gone out and done all those adventures, Shackleton down to Antarctica, Edmund Hillary, Percy Fawcett, all these guys, they were the Royal Geographical Society. They were going out and conquering this unknown world on behalf of these secret societies, of the crown, of the monarchy, of the power structure. And what happens as soon as America gets formed and settled in? Boom, you have another one form right here on this continent. And this guy comes out, Clarence Dutton, and he maps out not only the Grand Canyon, but he maps out a whole entire Pacific Northwest, and he goes over, maps out Hawaii. The guy was a polymath. He was brilliant. He names half the stuff in the Grand Canyon after Egyptian and Hindu gods, right? So when you go there, the South Rim, you're going to look at Isis Temple and Horus, Vishnu Schist. The rock is named Brahma Schist, on and on and on. And there's reasons for that. They say he asked the park rangers. He wanted it to be a worldly place belonging to everyone. So he gave it these names of religions and gods throughout the world so it would belong to the world. That's the official story. But he was a high-ranking Mason and educated in Ivy schools. There's more subtext there, you know. There's always another history.
Yes.
And he mapped out the entire Grand Canyon about the same time that Kincaid found that cave. And the railroad came in. And of course, they talk about moving the stuff on the rail lines all the way back. And that's right about the time, 1903, 1904, that the railroad got finished from Williams, Arizona, up to just north of Tucson. So it all fits. You start connecting the dots and it really all fits.
Yeah, it does. And in your piece about the Grand Canyon, towards the end, you basically just outlined that there's four stories that really relate to the rumor of a huge or special cave in the Grand Canyon. You have the initial article from 1909 we talked about. You have the Hopi creation story and their origin from an underworld within the Grand Canyon, which is something that's come up before on the show. And then you say the story of Seth Tanner and him losing his eyesight for entering forbidden caves. What's that about?
So Seth Tanner was a Mormon in the area there. He was a prospector, kind of a crazy dude, crazy cat. There's the Tanner Trail named after him. If you go to the tower on the east side of the South Rim there, it's a beautiful place. So that's where the Tanner Trail starts. And you can go down to the bottom. It is the gnarliest trail into the Grand Canyon. People who are experienced go down there. They're like, never again. It is just absolutely insanity. But Seth Tanner had himself a couple wives. He was a Mormon. One of them was a Hopi. And he was permitted to go down there and do his prospecting. They're like, yeah, we don't care what you do down there, you know? Indians referred to gold as the yellow rock that makes white men crazy. So they knew that we were after it, but they had no desire. So they said, by the way, there are some caves down there and just don't go in them. Just stay out of those caves. And they found him in those caves eventually. What's in those caves, we don't know. But they took him back to the tribe and they held a trial for him after a couple of days. The young braves wanted to kill him, but the elders said, no, we can't kill him. He's married to one of our women and he's part of the tribe, so we can't kill him as he didn't do anything that bad. So they rubbed something into his eyes, whether it was a powder or an acid, and they blinded him. Not completely, they say, just enough to where he can't find his way back there. They gave him enough eyesight, you know, they left enough to where he could, you know, kind of see shades and not trip over stuff and step on rattlesnakes. But they blinded him for all intents and purposes. And they said, this is so you're going to forget what you see. If you ever talk about what you saw, we're going to take your tongue. And there's a picture of him sitting there blind with his wife standing behind him. And his relatives, descendants, have the Tanner Trading Post right there on the east side of the Grand Canyon. I think it's not far from Farmington, if I'm not mistaken. And they'll tell you that story. And there's a picture of Seth in there. Allegedly, he told one of his sons on his deathbed that he was blinded because of he was in those caves and saw something that he was not supposed to. And those caves are the alleged Sipapu, or the emergence place from the third world to the fourth, and they're extremely sacred to the Hopi. Hmm. Now, you got to keep in mind that the Hopi are probably the most peaceful tribe on this continent. They lived up there on those mesas, and they lived out there toiling, walking up and down that mesa every day because, you know, there's no spring up there. So they had to walk down at the bottom for their water and come back up again. And it's because Masao, their god, said, this is to keep you out of trouble. If you have to labor every day, you will not have time to become corrupted. So they're very introspective, very peaceful, hardworking people. And for them to blind a guy for going in a cave, something's in that cave. Yeah. To this day, you can go up, you can take tours of the area, and the Hopis will take you up that canyon, but you ain't going to go to that cave. They're not going to take anyone other than Hopis into that cave area, and no one knows what's up there to this day. And that's right there at the confluence of where the Little Colorado meets the Colorado River. And that there is the general spot of where this cave is believed to have been. So that's one more tie-in. When you get into the, like I say, the Hopi creation story, they talked about giants, right? Masao, which is their Jesus-like figure, he's the go-between between man and God. He came down and said, everything is corrupted. There's giants in the land. All the DNA is corrupted. We're going to give you the ant people. The ant people will take you underground. You're going to live underground with the ant people, and Masao, the God's going to flood out the world. When all the evildoers are gone, you can come back up. So all that transpires, they climb a root of a spruce tree back up to the surface, and Masao is there again. He says, go forth and multiply. Basically, it is the story of Noah, only to the Native Americans. It includes giants, all that stuff, but they believe they came out of that area. And if you can take an anthropological viewpoint on this story, okay, and you don't want to believe the traditional story of the Hopi coming from gods and the floods, all that. They had come out of a cave system or out of the ground from the Grand Canyon. Well, this would jive, this would dovetail exactly with Kincaid's story of an underground cavern system that could hold 50,000 people in the Grand Canyon. So there's the dovetail.
And of course, a lot of people talk about this in the context of ancient aliens, like what are the ant people? What would an ant's eyes look like? And it's a little bit like the Greys.
Yeah.
They get into, inner earth lore. I'm a big fan of Hollow Earth, inner earth lore, regardless of, you know, what it really is.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Well, how about this one, Greg? I don't know if you know this or not, but do you know the word for ant in Hopi?
I don't.
It's Anu.
Ah.
And you know the word for people?
Naki.
Naki.
I love it, man. Seems like just the more you pull on these threads, the more credible some of them sound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to tie this into the broader context here, once again, you have Freemasonry. You have ancient civilizations from the Grand Canyon all the way down to Phoenix. And you have Masonry stepping in to grab control of that in the early beginning. It's just a common thread throughout the whole entire history of our state.
Absolutely. And so with that piece you had written, you said you had four stories that relate to the huge or special cave in the Grand Canyon. I mentioned a couple of them, and then Seth Tanner. And then the fourth one is a really fascinating read on your site about the sale of $28,000 in cave exploring gear to the Grand Canyon Park Service and this personal testimony regarding maybe the largest cave ever discovered in the U.S. by a park ranger. Tell us about that.
I don't retell that one too often these days, but I guess it's not a secret anymore. I used to work at a place called the Arizona Hiking Shack in North Phoenix on Cave Creek Road. And I was the rental troll. I'd ride my bicycle over there, right, every day after school, and I would get the rental gear ready. And this gentleman, Dale, the owner, he still owns it, actually, only it's moved to Central Phoenix now. He contracts with government. He contracts with search and rescue, the park service. He teaches skills, rappelling. He trains these people in rescue, on and on, on. So I moved to WikiUp, like I told you. I come back 10 years later. I pop in there. I'm like, Dale, how you doing? He's like, good, man. He's like, you still out there prospecting? I said, no, I'm writing now and this and that. And he says, hey, come here. I got something to tell you. You know how you were always talking about that cave in the Grand Canyon? I said, yeah. He goes, are you still looking for that? I said, yeah, I'm still looking for that. He says, well, the craziest thing happened just like a couple weeks ago. The Grand Canyon Park Service came in here and they put in an order. I said, what'd they order? He says, that's just it. They ordered 6,000 feet of static line rope. They ordered 24 harnesses, 24 helmets, lights, backup lights, ascenders, you know, Jumars, all the gear. I said, they're going on an expedition. He says, yeah, you're damn right they are. And I said, when they picking it up, he goes, well, that's just it. You know, 6,000 feet of rope, you can't just, it's not laying around. You have to have it, you know, made. So they're going to come back in a few weeks. And I said, well, did they say what they found? He says, no, they were really tight-lipped. It was the brass. It was the suits. I said, well, when they come back, you let me know. See if you can question them. So I come back about a month later. He says, yeah, they were in here. They came back and picked up all the gear. They sent a bunch of the kids, the rangers and trucks to grab all this stuff. And I said, and? He said, well, I bribed one of the kids. I gave him a figure eight and some gear. And he told me that they discovered a cavern system in the Grand Canyon that rivals that of any cave ever discovered to date in North America. And they're mounting an expedition to go in there. It's extremely tight-lipped. He says, almost no one knows about it, but we found it and we're going in. You know how big some of these caves are in this country, especially down in the Southeast. That's a pretty bold statement, Greg. Since then, I have periodically looked. There's nothing, absolutely nothing about any caves, any exploration. Of course, the top layer of the Grand Canyon is something called Kaibab limestone. That's from the last ocean here, right? Just under that, you have the Torweep and the Coconino sandstones. And beneath that, of course, you have more of the Supai group and the Tonto, all the way down through all those, all the stratification of all that rock. But wherever you find limestone, you do find caves. And wherever you find sandstone on Earth, you find people have pecked into that and made caves as well. So the entire stratification of all that rock bordering the Grand Canyon to where you can get into the canyon, that is all perfect, perfect substrate, perfect material for carving into the side and creating caverns. Mm. Anyway, they said that they found it there and they were going in. I've contacted ASU, nothing. There's absolutely zero. So, but we know he's got the sale records. He says, here it is. You know, I looked at him. They went in the Grand Canyon. That's what they found. And they went in years ago. And to the, whatever they found is tight-lipped. They haven't come out and said it.
Man. Well, you know, we've talked a lot about caves, and natural caves are awesome. You mentioned some carving, but what about underground development or cities or civilizations in the Southwest? How far do you go with that? How valid do you think some of those stories are?
I think they're extremely valid. And I think that, you know, like you mentioned earlier with Death Valley, right? They found that 25-mile underground cave system, supposedly belonged to the Paiutes. Interesting enough, the Paiutes were the only Native American tribe that had an afterlife story of an underground right there in the vicinity where that cave was. You have the Grand Canyon Mystery. You have all the caves up through Nevada. Once again, caves are synonymous with mystery and the underworld, and they're ubiquitous throughout Native American stories here. I think it's weird when we find underground cavern systems in Turkey, right?
Or
France, wherever. That's cool. You know, these people, that's what they did. But if they find one in America, oh, it just can't be. Just can't be. There's no way there can be an underground civilization in North America because there was just nobody here. And I think as researchers, we need to move past that and remove all those blocks that we've been told is the foundation that makes up the baseline academia from where most anthropologists and archaeologists start at. I have moved past that. I recognize mainstream academia as a control mechanism.
Yeah.
They're funded, right? The money is allotted. The people move their way up through the ranks, just like a military. The young students will jump on to the same hypothesis and support the same theory, and they then are given tenure, and then they are funded, and they take the next generation. The arc of history of archaeology, it turns very slowly. Didn't somebody say one time, history changes one death at a time? Right? Something like that.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Voltaire said it too. You know, history is the lie most commonly agreed upon.
Yes.
It's been said a million ways. History is wonderful, if only if it were true. It is obvious to me through my 20 years of research that there is a story that has been woven and it has been reinforced by mainstream academia. Of course, they turn around and brand us all these alternative archaeologists, right? Kooks and conspiracy theorists and fringe archaeologists. And that's where they've relegated us to. But the good news is, Greg, we no longer have to get the approval of some professor at ASU or NAU. You can call me and we can talk about this stuff. You can call other researchers and say, yeah, because I know this guy and he says this. And we can sharpen our ideas and throw away the stuff that doesn't make any sense. We can hone this stuff down on our own. And that's what's been going on for the last 15 years.
Yes.
And that's why they are attempting to tear down the internet right now, because we are getting to the heart of this stuff. We're putting the pieces together ourselves. And this is dangerous for them.
They're trying to just commercialize and corporatize the internet and put more cat videos in front of us to bombard us with mediocrity so we don't get to the depths in which you and I talk about these kind of things. But hey, it's been the Wild West as long as we've known it, and we've been lucky to have it, and we're still kicking, so it's great.
It is, and to carry that thought further, when we jump off this rock and we colonize space, it's not going to be the cashiers at Walmart, right? It's not going to be the mechanic. It's going to be the MIT graduates and the techs, right. The same families. They're the ones that are going to be there.
And the military, right?
Yeah, from the earliest Europe and going off and through the monarchy and all the way to America and the Western expansion, it's the same game. It's just going to be a new paradigm.
Right. They'll whitewash it for us and then let us come in.
You're exactly right. Bingo.
Oh, man. So I also wanted to ask you about the Sedona region, because anyone who's familiar with it knows that it's a hotbed for crystals and metaphysical shops and has a real New Agey reputation.
Mm-hmm.
There are also a lot of rumors and speculation about vortexes in the area, and you have a pretty detailed map of what you call the Sedona landscape chakra map.
Yeah.
And it does form the type of pattern of circles and pentagrams that are familiar to anyone who's looked into sacred geometry or the chakra system of the body.
Mm-hmm.
What is this about? Can you talk to us about the science behind the Sedona vortexes, how you think that all shakes out?
So anything anyone's ever said about Sedona is probably true. Kind of like America, right?
Yeah.
It is the New Age capital of Arizona, and it is known for its vortice, right? A plural for vortex. It's vortice. And some people believe it, and some people don't. I take a physics point of view on it, a scientific point of view, as well as a historical going back to the Native Americans. Today, if you go there, like you said, you are going to see metaphysics shops and crystal shops, and you can get your auras photographed, and you know, it's just a playground for that kind of stuff. Every religion you would ever want to imagine is there as well. There are religions and kooky religions. I don't remember a couple years ago when that guy had that sweat lodge and three people died from liver failure or kidney failure. There's a lot of charlatans up there. People pretending to be Native Americans. So there's the dark side of that whole New Age movement there as well, and the undercurrents. But it is a vibrant tourist area as well. For the metaphysical aspect of it, it is the vortex, or the vortice. And there's seven main vortice there. Interesting enough, the town of Sedona does not talk about them. They give this little cheap piece of paper map out, an 8x11 map that have these little swirlies on it. And that's all they'll tell you. Alleged vortex, right? They don't even get into it. They don't even want to talk about that. But there are people who go to these vortex points and they feel things. I myself, there's one in particular called Airport Mesa Vortex. And I feel, honest to God, if I was to put my phone on vibrate and stick it right in the middle of my chest cavity and feel an internal vibration, that's what it would feel like to me. When I go up on that thing and sit there, I can feel it. I really can. When I jump off this rock and get away from it, it subsides and it goes away. And to give you the background on Sedona, it's always been a cattle town, no mining, but it was always cattle and ranchers up until the 80s, actually the late 70s. A woman named Paige Bryant, and she was from California, and she was a hippie and she's into crystals, and she was working for Pink Jeep Tours, same company I used to work for, with doing Jeep Tours up there. And she would take people out and say, all right, and this is the vortex point here and blah, 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 blah. And they said, hey, Paige, we don't give vortex tours. You can't do that. We're not into that. We're about the desert. So she breaks off and makes her own company and starts giving like these metaphysical paranormal vortex tours, right? Go capital. Yeah. Awesome stuff. And she gets a group of other girls and they give these tours. And it's successful. And right about then, right when Paige does this, is when it starts being known to be this vortex New Age crystal. And that just starts building and building. And it's never stopped. It's never stopped building from that point. That was not the first time, however. When I did this article, I went deep. And there was a woman, Mary something or other. She was there in the 50s. And she was holding seances, right? So the 40s and 50s. I think Manly P. Hall even showed up there one time and spoke, right?
Wow.
There was a gentleman who wrote a book in the 50s saying there were four power points on Earth, two masculine and two feminine. And for this case here, the one in Hawaii, the Red Rocks, I don't know where that is, point over there, that was the masculine. And its other one, the female one, was right here in Sedona. So he wrote that book in the 50s and it went out, and that's why Mary was there, and they were holding these seances and metaphysical things there. So it's always been a point, at least since the 40s and 50s. It's always been a place for these energies. Today, if you go to Sedona, you will find the vortex points, and they're all lined up on a fault line. And that, to me, when you get into physics, that's where the rubber hits the road, right? Two guys went in here with magnetometers, and they started feeling out the magnetic fields, and they found these points. Yep, they're right where they said they are. They have a stronger magnetic field. The whole area is the red rock of Sedona. It's beautiful because it has a layer of hematite that went through all that sandstone and became oxidized. So you have a lot of oxidized and iron in the soil. So it's all magnetized to a certain point. But these seven points are even more powerful. And they do align with Native American stories of those power points as well. So some people feel things. Some people go into deep meditations on these points. People feel different. Some people don't feel anything at all. But I think it is a natural engine. I think there is something to it. Like one of my Navajo friends told me, that a medicine man related to him, we have these lines that come through the reservation. You guys call them ley lines. The Chinese call them dragon lines. Well, where they cross, bad things happen. I don't know if you know this or not, but when you build a home up on the Navajo res, the medicine man has to come out and he has to witch it, right? And he has to tell you, no, you got to go 50 feet that way because this line's going through your house and it'll cause alcoholism and violence, right? Did you know every time they build a Catholic church, a priest has to come out and look at the ground and make sure it's okay?
Not really.
Yeah, same thing. You ask any Catholic, they have to do that. So there are points. There is real energy that's measured. And Sedona is a hotbed for this energy. And it affects different people different ways.
Yeah, I mean, it is fascinating. You mentioned magnetic iron in the area. Obviously, it's going to have an effect on the body. All the ley lines. There's a fault line that exposed quartz crystal from the crust. And quartz crystal said to have properties that affect the body. And you list a lot of the claims about Sedona, especially the furthest out ones. And of course, those are going to be my favorite. I really liked this one where you say The Earth's crust is thinnest in the American Southwest, and this is the reason extraterrestrials have chosen to construct underground bases and operate here. It makes for far less Earth to have to travel through, coming in and out of their subterranean systems. The magnetic properties of the red rocks due to the iron oxides found therein become a natural energy field, and the ships power and recharge themselves by flying around the Sedona area. Here they communicate with humans telepathically, giving wisdom, love, and insight into our universe in an ever-moving, pay-it-forward core belief system, which we ourselves will engage in someday upon attaining their level of enlightenment and technology.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I love that. I mean, I know you're just kind of throwing out the claims about the area, but can you elaborate on your thoughts on that particular paragraph?
I worked in Sedona for so long, I have heard every single theory and claim, many of which have complete religions constructed around them. And that's one of them. Mm-hmm. They believe that there is a lot of UFO activity in the area. And indeed, there is. There's a site. I think this article links to it. You can go there and find the top UFO sightings by county in America. And there's two counties, one in Northern Oregon and one from Coconino County, where Sedona starts and goes due north through Flagstaff all the way to the Grand Canyon. That is the number two most witnessed UFO sightings annually in North America. Sedona is a hotbed. You can take UFO tours in Sedona. I don't know if you know that or not. You can go online and you can go there. I'll give you night vision goggles. You can go out there and watch UFOs. Hell, when I was a cowboy, I used to go out there and watch stuff nighttime in Wiki Up Sky. Stuff flies around our deserts all the damn time. It's not if, but how many you're going to see when you go out there at night. There is a ranch just off to the west of Sedona called the Bradshaw Ranch. And it's been there for many, many years. They just sold out. They were forced to sell out at the coercion of the Bureau of Land Management, necking down his water and allotted amount of cattle he could run on that ranch. It got taken over by the government. It got fenced off. A very good friend of mine lives there, and she rides her horse up and down and through them canyons and all over that area. Bit of a hippie. And she rode up on that years ago, and there were armed guards at that ranch. People see stuff taking off out of that Bradshaw Ranch and landing in there on a regular basis. In fact, some of them UFO tours will go to the edge of that Bradshaw Ranch, but it is guarded. There's locks on that, and there are armed guards there sometimes. What's interesting to note, as the crow flies, if you go due north of the Bradshaw Ranch, up through the Red Rock Secret Wilderness, all the way to I-40, there is a military base up there. It's called Camp Navajo. And that's where we store a lot of our nuclear warheads. We knew this because the locals have seen NATO coming through. It was NATO or the UN doing annual inspections. There's a lot of underground storage there. I wrote an article about DUMS, deep underground military bases, and that right there fits the exact blueprint of where you would put an underground base. And that is, as the crow flies, not that far from the Bradshaw Ranch in Sedona. If you did have an underground base in the area, that would account for a lot of that UFO activity. To take this even further back on a whole nother level, the Navajos talk about the Star Brothers and the Star Sisters who came down and talk with them regularly. Saved a couple children up in the mountains one time and brought them home and left them the gift of muskmelon seeds and different seeds and plants they didn't have prior, which could be an alien species, you know, giving gifts of agriculture. But all these stories from ancient times up to modern day are still probably. You can go to Sedona today and I guarantee you talk to anyone there and someone's going to have seen UFOs. Guaranteed.
I love it, man. And so we're getting pretty late in the show, and there were several other things I wanted to ask you about, but let's jump to McCain and modern times. Oh. Talk about his Masonic funeral ritual. Obviously, he was a state senator from Arizona. We have all this rich history and Freemasonic founders and all these modern symbolic structures around the area. So you'd think McCain was knowledgeable or privy to at least some of this under the radar context. Talk to us about the details of his funeral ceremony that you find most curious. What was really going on there?
Okay, let me preface this by saying we talked earlier about this off air for a minute, but my website and my YouTube channel has been under attack. It has been under attack since this article came out. I can trace back my analytics to the day after this article came out when I started declining in viewership. John McCain, senator for 27, 29 years, something like that, in Arizona. Unshakable. I don't know a person who votes for him, but somehow he maintained that position all these years. Not my favorite cat, but he was definitely a globalist. If you follow politics, you listen to this show, you know he is a globalist. Not necessarily Democrat, not necessarily Republican. He is a globalist.
Right.
John McCain, when you go through his funeral, first of all, he received one of the longest funerals in the history of any dignitary in U.S. history. Longer than, I think, any other president. Right? Wow. It was a 5-day ritual. We're going to go through this. I'm going to make this as short as I can here. But when I saw this unraveling, and we've talked about a lot of things about Arizona and the ancient, you know, aspects of it. We didn't talk very much about my modern day work, which is de-occulting the political aspects of this state. And that's what I'm on to these days. And when I saw this unraveling, it was just red flag after red flag. First of all, John McCain, he died, I believe, on the 25th. Is that correct?
Yeah, August 25th.
Yeah, August 25th. He died on August 25th. His body rested for 3 days, the 26th, 27th, 28th. This ritual began on the 29th, okay, where he was laid in the Arizona State Rotunda and for a day for viewing. At that point, the next day he went to the Baptist Church where they did a funeral service there, and he was spent traveling for the remainder of the day all the way to Washington, D.C., where he spent another day at the U.S. Capitol Rotunda, okay? Then it went on to the cemetery. It was laid in the final deal. Okay, first things first. John McCain was not only the 13th senator to ever lie in state under the rotunda at the U.S. Capitol, but he was also the 33rd person to lie in state there as well. What are the odds of John McCain being the 13th senator and the 33rd person to ever lie in that spot? We know that the York Rite of Freemasonry has 13 degrees and the Scottish Rite has 33. That right there seals the deal out the gate for me, okay? But when you start going through the timeline and the Masonic symbology and symbolism happening here, he spent 3 days resting. He died the 25th. The funeral began the 29th. Okay. He was a senator for Arizona, and he lived in Phoenix as well as the Sedona area. When the Phoenix bird dies, it burns up to ashes, and 3 days later, it is reborn again. Okay. Masonic tradition says, Greek mythology as well as the Mason, says that that bird then flies east. Okay. Well, that's exactly what happened. John McCain died. His body rested for 3 days where nothing happened. He laid in state at the rotunda in Arizona, and then his body flew east to Washington, D.C., and it laid in the rotunda for a day there. I want everyone listening to this right now to go on Google Maps. I want you to go to the U.S. Capitol. I want you to get the ruler out tool, click it right there on the center, and go straight down the mall, straight down the Capitol Mall, and keep going and keep going and keep going across this entire country until you get to the Arizona Capitol. The Arizona Capitol and the U.S. Capitol are lined up exactly. It's right down the mall. It goes through the Washington Monument. It goes through the Lincoln Memorial all the way. There is not one other place of significance between the U.S. Capitol Rotunda and the Phoenix Rotunda between the two, okay? So McCain's body laid for 3 days. It rose from the ashes, symbolically speaking. It flew east. Masons, if you are a Mason and you go to a town and somebody suspects you of being a fellow Mason, back in the day, they would say, sir, are you a traveling man? And that was the code. And if the other Mason was, he would say, yes, I am, sir. I travel from the west to the east. And he says, what is it that you seek in the east? I seek the point of illumination. That was code. That's the little backhanded verbal handshake that Masons give each other. They revere the east as where the sun rises. It's all solar worship, right? It's all wrapped up in the Masonry ancient and back to Egypt. Yeah, ancient, all the ancient shit. So another thing, going through the numerology of McCain's funeral here. McCain died 72 days after Donald Trump's 72nd birthday. I find that strange. not as strange as him dying exactly 72 days before the midterm elections, right? So what are the odds of him dying exactly 72 days after his birthday and exactly 72 days before the exact point of the average of the midterm elections, right? I don't know. It's just when you go through the numerology of this all the way down, it's one after another after another.
And 72.
Yeah.
Why that number?
72 is a fixative. When you talk about ritual, and my website goes into this in certain articles pretty heavy, 72 is a fixative number, is a fixative vibrational frequency. Pythagoras said all is number. When these Masons, when these occultists make these rituals, 9/11 was a ritual. The Vegas shooting was a ritual. The Florida shooting was a ritual. These are rituals enacted as sacrifices, utilizing numerology to realize vibrational frequencies so they can create and change reality as we know it. That's what is going on here. These memorials and the services, all this stuff is nothing more than ripping the scab off a wound and harnessing all these negative emotions and fear and pain, right? 72, it is a number that grounds it. It fixes it to the earth. Mm-hmm. When you go through numerology in 72, you know, in the Bible, of course, you have the 72 names of God, right? Man is average age of 72, average speaking. He has 72 heartbeats per minute. He's 72% water. Earth is 72% water as well. On and on and on. 72 is the most comfortable temperature that humans are comfortable at, right? Degrees, room temperature. Mm-hmm. It goes on and on and on all the way down the line. But 72 is built into the human condition. And the reason being is because it is the amount of years for one degree of precession.
Right.
Precession is the advancement of the wobble of the earth due to its tilt off its axis. So all of the mechanics that we are feeling and experiencing biologically, that we are synced into biologically, 72 is the overarching pattern, or maybe another pattern, which is thrown into that resonance, which is having a definite effect. So when you utilize that number in a ritual, you are grounding it to earth and earthly effects. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And I read your article as well about 72 kind of in connection with SETI, because the wow signal was supposed to be 72 minutes long. And then now they recently said that they have found 72 new radio signals. So there's something weird about this, because when you hear those numbers, you think, okay, this is a false story, or there's a story behind the story, or they're trying to do something. I think in the article you suggested that they were kind of doing this subconscious disclosure, trying to get people ready, because this number is something that your deep subconscious recognizes, and then later some other story will emerge.
Without a doubt. And by the way, to bring it full circle here, and I'll come right back, those platform mounds for the ancient Hohokam here in the Phoenix Valley, I didn't tell you, they found little notches on the east and west walls, and they didn't know what they were until about the mid-1970s. They found out that they were measuring where the moon rose and sat on the horizon. And the only information you can extrapolate from that, if you reverse engineer that data after 200 years of data collection, is precession. Hmm. So the ancient Hohokam were measuring precession here, even though they didn't leave any written language or mathematics to bring that full circle. But back to McCain here, right? 93 is also found in here as well. 93 in Thelema, when you add up the dates, the 29, 30, 31, first and second are the dates that all transpired on. That was the 5-day ritual of McCain's funeral. That adds up to 93. Well, if you know about Aleister Crowley and Thelema, 93 is a base pattern of time construction. It is of this world. And that's why he was so big on that number. In fact, I think they will sign their letters and their opening greeting with 93, because that is the numerological equivalent to the word Thelema. But if you look at the face of a clock, right, the 12 and the 6 at opposite ends add up to 18. 1 plus 8 is 9. The 9 and the 3 across add up to 12. 1 plus 2 is 3. 93, right there on a clock. Base pattern of time construction. That right there is also in John McCain's funeral. I wrote an article a few months back called The Anatomy of a Ritual. And I go through kind of like a recipe, because I used to practice witchcraft when I was a kid, right? When I was young, I say kid, my 18 to 28. And I understand how it works, the mechanics of it. And this article, I wrote a two-part article about the mechanics of witchcraft. It's basically harnessing physics. You're harnessing energy, emotion, and catalysts. And you're taking those vibrational resonance of the catalysts and you're using them to project or springboard out an intent, and your emotion is the gasoline. And if you can get this good enough and you can learn to flex those muscles of emotion, you can make magic. This is nothing less than what charismatic people do when they're on stage.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Morrison, Jimi Hendrix. There's no difference in my mind between witchcraft and physics. None. It's the same exact science. Those guys that were practicing alchemy in the dungeons of castles and coming up with new concoctions and ideas, those are the same cats we got today at Texas Instruments and MIT, bending space and time and refracting light and pushing the known boundaries of what we call reality. I'll tell you something cool, man. I had a tour a couple years back. You ever heard of Zeiss Glass?
No.
Zeiss Glass makes the highest end glass for lasers on Earth, for surgical lasers, military lasers, all that stuff. They also make scopes for like hunting, the best glass company in the world. I got these CEOs and we're cruising through the state. I'm like, so what are you guys working on now? You know? And he's like, kind of got all tight lipped. I said, I know you guys make scopes. He says, yeah, but we're a little bit beyond that. He says, we do military contracts now. I said, what do you mean? He says, we figured out that there are properties within light that have previously been untapped and unharnessed. We are pulling those properties out and putting them to use. That's what our main field of research is now.
Oh, man, that is cool.
That's the equivalent to dark energy, but on the other side, you know, which makes me think of like Job, you know, Job 72, Job 28, where God comes down and starts really tearing into Job and his buddies. And he lists off these 72 questions like, where were you when I did this? Well, he asks a question, you know, not the mysteries I have hidden in the ice and the snow. And a lot of people have taken that to mean the reflection of light as it comes through snow and ice. But it all comes full circle, you know?
Yeah, that's so cool. And those details of the numerology of McCain's funeral, it's just like, they're so calculated. It seems like this is just all a big theater production in a simulation. Of course, these are their rituals, but to have the ability to actually construct them as they do, it's mind-blowing.
So he also died on a 25th, and the 25th was a full moon, 99% illumination, right? When you're working moon magic, you're grabbing the energy of the moon. It's the most powerful catalyst that we can use as humans because we're all synced up to the moon acutely, right? It's not a secondary vibrational resonance. It is an acute primary one. So if you can sync up your work or your intent with the moon, it's going to be twice as powerful. Did you notice, by the way, that Kavanaugh was just confirmed and took his oath on a full moon yesterday?
I didn't.
Okay. John McCain died on the 25th, which was one day. You can technically grab one day either of a full or a new moon and harness roughly 95, 99% of the available energy. But you do diminishing magic or diminishing work on a full moon because you're letting that, as that light gets less and less, it's going to pull your intent and you're going to diminish whatever. You're going to want to build on a new moon. So if you follow Trump when he makes certain speeches, he'll do them on a full moon. When he took off to the Pacific, remember the first thing he did last year? He went and did the Pacific trade.
Yeah.
That was launched on a new moon because he was building. He released the Nunez memo on the 33rd day of the year, February 2nd, as a code to the Freemasons. You watch Trump, everything that guy, by the way, Trump is Jesuit trained. Everything Trump does is either in link with a moon phase or a specific day as it resonates to an intent or sending a message. Go through your Masonic holidays and learn all those, and you'll see that he does and says certain things three times. When he says something three times in a speech, it's a message to the Masons.
Hmm.
That's the bulk of my current work on my site that I'm getting, because it's just too rich not to dive into.
Right.
I mean, if any occultist, once you look at one of Trump's speeches through this lens, you're going to be like, oh my God, there it is. There it is. But there was nothing about McCain's funeral that was not a ritual. And if you remember, he specifically uninvited publicly Trump to his funeral.
Right.
This was all about diminishing Trump's ability. And I hate to make, I'm not a Trump zealot by any stretch.
Good,
he has some good points and bad points. But he's done a lot of good stuff, but he's done some bad stuff as well, like bombing Syria. And I can't get behind that shit. Mm-hmm. But McCain was definitely a globalist. And he viewed Trump as the number one threat to their agenda. John McCain, I'm saying conclusively, without a doubt, designed himself, because he planned his own funeral out. He designed his funeral to be his last work, his last ritual that would carry the energy of his intent to try and subvert Trump.
And do you think he really died?
That's just it. Did he really die? You know, I had in my mind that he did because, you know, we're just programmed to believe that. Then I heard that a few weeks later. I'm like, well, you know what? Maybe he didn't.
The White House did re-raise the flag as if to say, like, though this isn't a big deal, or also, you know, he didn't attend the funeral.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's weird things about that.
Did you watch that little short clip where Acacia says, after we put John McCain to death?
Yes, yes. That's a weird clip, but for people to have some context, you play it. It's from Fox News or something. John Kasich is being interviewed, and he says the phrase, oh, well, you know, before we put John McCain to death. It's like, what? What? That's a weird phrasing of, you know, he passed. But
yeah,
it is what it is. You mentioned that Trump, and I don't really want to get too deep into politics,
because
the stuff we've been talking about is so much more interesting than these fucking idiots. But
right?
You know, it's just, and it's also way more universally interesting. Politics is so polarizing. But you mentioned Trump is a trained Jesuit, and, you know, McCain, of course, is a globalist. I think a lot of these secret organizations are so intertwined and co-opted at this point, it's really hard to parse out. But I guess, is your general assessment that the secret war beneath the scenes is between globalists or Freemasons and Jesuits?
I think that is one battle taking place.
Right.
I really do. And as you know, probably better than I, you can get into this stuff and go down some holes and you don't know where you were at in 5 minutes.
Yes.
From all these organizations. And if you got the Jews over here trying to conquer the world, and you got the Catholics trying to conquer the world, and you got, you know, Jesuits, it's like, yeah, okay, who's going to really control the world here? But you realize at a certain point that not everyone knows what's going on, and there is a lot of fighting taking place. Catholics, as we know, are the only religion that has a seat at the UN, right?
Mm.
So they're not a religion, they're a theocracy. And they control the ideas of 25% of the Earth's population. That's not a religion. That's a political movement.
Yeah.
You have battles with the Freemasonry. And yeah, I believe the Freemasons, in my mind, can be changed. But where I'm at now and what I know, what I've studied, the Freemasons appear to me to be the worker bees of some overarching agenda to get humans on a certain path and work us into a certain order. And I believe they believe it's for all of our best interests. I know a lot of Freemasons, right? And they're good people. They're not bent on world domination and, well, at least overtly sacrifice people. They're decent people. They're just,
well, those lower levels, I think, provide the PR cover for the upper levels.
Exactly. Once you get into the higher levels of Freemasonry, however, you start getting to the, you have to, you know, basically follow Lucifer, quite literally. And that's what all the whistleblowers have said when they dump out of it. But there is a lot of battling going on. And just to get back to Trump for a second, when I looked at the last election, I saw that the Democrats were scared to death of Trump, which was okay. I get it. But he's been a lifelong Democrat. He just swapped over to run. And then when I saw the Republicans scared to death of Trump, my ears perked up. And I'm like, huh, why the hell are they scared to death of him? And then I realized that the left and the right were both, you know, two wings on the same bird of prey, picking the flesh off the American people. And they were going to lose their ability to control because Trump was going to throw a monkey wrench in it. And he has. He's been attacked. And I don't agree with everything that the guy does by any stretch. But he has been attacked relentlessly, nonstop, worse than any other president in U.S. history. And there's a reason for it. And I believe he is attempting to dismantle the globalism. If you go through my YouTube channel, you'll find where I go through the speeches that he makes. And he specifically, especially on that last UN speech, when he addressed him last week, he specifically said anti-globalism. He spoke against globalism every 5 minutes, that entire speech. That was the crux of his entire speech.
Well, that is fair. And I would go with you to the extent to say that, well, I mean, it's my impression that all presidents are pretty much just selected figureheads or frontmen. But I would say that there's a good chance that they were scared of some unseen force that they knew he represented, that he was in allegiance with. Like you mentioned, all of his, moves are made on moon cycles or in connection with them. I don't think he's keeping a moon calendar. I think there's people behind him that are like, this is when you do this, this is when you do that. There, you know, he just is going with the flow. Yep. But I would go with you and agree to the extent to say that there definitely seems to be some infighting amongst groups that has bubbled up to the surface. There seems to be a massive change in direction in the American policy, a massive pivot. And it's probably directed by some emergence of a group that has laid low or splintered or something. And they chose this time to emerge, and he's their weird figurehead. But
yeah, exactly. Could Trump be that secret weapon of the globalists? He very well could be, for all we know at this point. We don't know. We don't know what's going to happen, because I think this chessboard is bigger. You and I we're just looking at the small parts, but we're not privy to all that knowledge of all the underworkings, you know?
Yeah.
Who knows what's going to happen? I had a discussion with my friend the other day who's an evangelical Christian. And I said, do you think he could be the Antichrist? You know, because read Revelations, it talks about, you know, the Antichrist. He says, no, because he's not a Jew. But, you know, his son-in-law is.
Yeah. And there's also that thing about it'll be ushered in with trumpets, and there's Trump Pence.
Yeah. When Trump put his hand on the Bible and took that oath of office, he was, what, 70 years, 7 months and 7 days old? 777, you know? I wrote a really great article last year after the inauguration about 19.5 and the ritual that takes place every 4 years on the steps of the Capitol, right? The Washington Monument is the phallic symbol of Osiris. We all know that. And the Capitol building is the ever-pregnant belly of Isis. And every 4 years, according to the will of the American people, supposedly, we vote and we get out the old blood. We usher in the new blood, the new ideas, according to the current will of the people. And it's like a menstrual cycle. The founding fathers designed our political system to mimic that of the physiological cycle of a female. Quite symbolically, where all the ideas, the matriarchal force that is the Capitol, is where that ceremony takes place, to where that president swears his oath on that Bible facing the phallic symbol of Osiris. Right? This is a ritual. It takes place 19.5 days into the new year. It takes place on the 20th, exactly at noon, because midnight would be 20 days in the year. So 19.5 is noon. If you watch the last inauguration, the guy picks his foot up, and I timed with my atomic clock, his foot hits that balcony at exactly noon, atomic noon. It was a ritual. And it took place in 19.5. I'm sure you've covered all kinds of researchers about 19.5 in NASA.
Yes, yes.
Right? Yeah, ties into that. There's rituals embedded in our entire political system. And I find it fascinating. And this is what I write about. This is what I do. So
yes, I definitely am with you that there's ritual magic in play. There might even be a division in play. But what bothers me about a lot of the alternative media now is the jumping to the conclusion that that means Trump is a savior or champion of the American middle class. That I don't see. Empires pivot, empires change guard and change their outfits. But even if he's fighting the globalists, that does not mean that our lives will be any better. Empires fight each other all the time in that Game of Thrones type of way.
I would say even if he appears to be fighting the globalists. Is he really? Who knows?
That's true too. Absolutely. So I'm glad that, you know, we're both resistant to drinking too much Kool-Aid on the Trump thing, because a lot of the alternative community is having a rough go at that. But I wanted to broach one more topic. I know we're deep, deep into this thing, but related to McCain, you also wrote about the Black Eye Club. And I just was so psyched to see this on your website, because I definitely think something's up with that. For people who don't know, a lot of power elites have had black eyes that look pretty brutal. Of course, John McCain is one of those people. And the cover stories for these accidents are usually pretty transparent. It does seem like some sort of rituals being covered up here. But talk to us about this weird thread and your thoughts about it in general.
There is something going on where dignitaries, politicians, famous people in Hollywood are winding up with black eyes, usually the left, but sometimes the right. And I've asked my Masonic friends, they won't tell me nothing. You know, I'm of the opinion that there is a ritual where they're getting punched in the face, or some kind of surgical procedure where they're cutting that eye right there on the side, because always at the eye. But Harry Reid, black eye, two of them actually, right? John Kerry, Black Eye, Prince Andrew, John McCain, Michael Noonan, Prince Philip. It goes on and on. Pope Francis, Pope Benedict, Madonna, Kanye West, Kelly Osbourne, Robert Downey Jr., Ryan Gosling, Richard Branson, Lady Gaga. It just goes on and on and on.
Yep.
Justin Bieber, right? Steve Buscemi. And a lot of people believe that there's something going on, some kind of a ritual where they're getting punched. And that makes sense. It really does make sense to me. By the way, when I wrote this article here, this is my number one article, and it has been since I put it out, thousands of views a day. But people have written about this prior to me, soul scalping. There's a woman, Sherry Schreiner, talks about soul scalping, and she gets into the alien theory that they're being abducted and they're doing something with an alien implant in the eye. I don't necessarily ascribe to all that, but I put that on there because, I
put it on the table.
Put it on the table. She feels it, and maybe there's something to it there. I think it might be a checks and balances. I think the Pope isn't even above reproach. And I think, maybe the Pope went out there and said something he wasn't supposed to, and he gets called into his masters and they say, stand up straight. Boom.
Right. It's some initiation or some kind of punishment, but you're right. The list is long.
Yeah.
And I kept, you named most of the people I had written down on the list, but a couple of their excuses or their explanations are quite telling as well. George W. Bush said he choked on a pretzel, fainted, and fell off the couch. John Kerry said he was playing hockey. Prince Andrew refused to comment. McCain said it was blood clot removal. Prince Philip, another, refused to comment. Pope Francis hit his face on the Pope Mobile. Pope Benedict just fell. Madonna was playing peekaboo with her baby. Kanye West said he was randomly attacked. Robert Downey Jr., no comment. It is just interesting. It goes through religious leaders, yeah, political leaders in Hollywood, which we all know are pretty synergistic and involved in the same kind of secret orders across the board. They're compartmentalized on the surface, but not behind the scenes.
Yeah. And when I talk about this stuff anymore, I don't even pretend like they're not involved in this stuff. If people listening to this don't understand that there is dark, ancient, ritualistic magic at play in our entertainment system and our political system and our daily life and our judicial system, I don't have to tell you, it's there. It's been there the whole entire time. And at no time in the history of our species have we ever had more ability to tap into it and understand it for people doing what you and I are doing right now. It really is frustrating when people don't take note of that and just dismiss it as a conspiracy theory when, I don't know, what else do you say to that,
Right. I'm with you.
It's just so frustrating.
Well, man, this has been really interesting. A lot of fun. I know there's so much more to talk about. Hopefully we can do it again sometime.
I'd love to.
Great. Until then, do remind the people where to find your website and any other work you got going on.
I got my website. I'm a one-man show. It is thephoenixenigma.com. Thephoenixenigma.com. Of course, I got a Patreon there because I'm just, if you want to support my work, please, I could really use it. Other than I'm not going to beg for money, but if you would like to support it, that is there as well. I would appreciate it if you do. I have a YouTube channel where I cover the majority of my political deoccultings. And the website, even though it's been more political, I am gearing back into the Phoenix area as of recently. There's a lot of stuff I've been working on behind the scenes, and some of it's come to fruition. My book should be out early next year, or maybe mid next year. I have to get it edited, and it's going to be concentrating on the fingerprints of masonry in the Phoenix area. And that's all it's going to be about, going deep into what we didn't talk a lot about today. If you want to do another show on that, by all means, give me a call and we can talk about just that.
Yeah. When the book launches, we should.
Yeah. It's going to be a book dedicated to just that. And it's fascinating stuff. But, and then on my website, I throw in some stuff, some fun stuff about cactus every once in a while, just stuff that interests me being a botanist and whatnot. So that's my work. That's what I do. Mm-hmm.
Well, it is a great website. And in the interest of trying to coax out some support, do you have any Patreon-specific content for those people that do support you financially?
I will. I just opened my Patreon a few weeks ago, so it's brand new. And I will be making one video a month for just them. I got a couple. I don't have too many tiers. I wanted to make it really simple. I think I got a $3, $5, and a $10, and maybe an advertising one for $60 a month. If you got something you want to sell, put an ad on my website for $60, leave it there. We'll work it out. Give me a call. We need to help each other out in this genre.
Yes, I agree. I agree. Well, awesome. Again, fascinating stuff. I do wish I had a guy like you in every weird city across America. Major respect for doing this work, and I hope you keep it up. Thanks for taking the time to go over some of it, and take care out there.
Well, thank you for your time today. I do appreciate it.
You got it. Heyo, Higher Side Chatters. Back in the saddle. Another one on the books. Corey Daniel with the Fire of a Thousand Suns. I don't really know what I'm saying, guys, but I thought that was a fucking pretty solid show, if you ask me. When I found the Phoenix Enigma website, I saw more than enough to know we could have a good time. Thankfully, Corey actually got back to me, and we were able to forge a pretty fun path through his work. And he's a pretty good speaker for not having done very many interviews. Hopefully he's going to get more requests now, because I'm sure there are a decent amount of podcast hosts listening who are going to want to pick his brain. And that's great. I've lived in some rural areas, but nothing as barren as the Arizona desert. And I just think it's really impressive that he has cultivated all this knowledge, spent time with people even less connected to society, and just heard their tales, old ranchers and prospectors. These are the sorts of insights that I would love to dig out of obscurity and broadcast to all you guys. I just get the special tingle from that. I don't know why. But what I was getting at is that even though I had a lot of questions and material fleshed out, I started to feel like getting a lot more open-ended because these little side stories and anecdotes tended to come out a bit more. And that is, to me, one of those in-the-moment things you got to go with because you're not going to get it next time. I can always pull up his articles again if we have another show. I wanted to follow a few more of those personal leads. And I think there are a lot of small town stories, so to speak, that die out because they aren't told. Luckily, the technology makes it possible for us to reach those remote areas before it slowly kills us. I thought this episode fit nicely with Michael Wan of the Susquehanna River Alchemy episode and Ross Ben with the Philadelphia Ben Franklin Show, as I said in the beginning. And this was obviously a bit broader than the description of some overarching ritual, but I still feel like we got our hands all over the elephant. There's definitely more meat on the esoteric Freemasonic Phoenix bone, but now I do feel like Phoenix is a pretty special place to those settlement sorcerers, and it's not a city that was on my radar really at all. I just can't imagine soaking up all this knowledge that he has, largely in isolation. For me, it's just nice to be able to appreciate and then amplify that. And I hope you were into it too. I can't imagine you wouldn't be if you're a THC fan. I'm not so sure about the jungle cultures versus desert cultures and violence thing, the more I think about it though. Because like, look at the Middle East. That's pretty violent. Look at shamanism in the Amazon. I know that's just an element of culture, but it has to create a little bit of a peaceful environment. I really just don't know enough about that to be weighing in or speculating, but when Corey brought it up, I thought it was an interesting concept. I definitely could understand how the environment would have such an effect on the psyche. I looked up some articles that said that it's just the more warmer it is, the more violent a culture is. I don't think it's that simple. I mean, maybe it's just more general irritation. The heat is irritating. But so are the bugs of the jungle that you wouldn't get in the desert. You know, give me a week of that and I'd be pretty ready to rip somebody's head off. I don't know. But in THC news, I am sorry for the large gap in shows. I had two on the calendar that had to be pushed back a couple weeks. So I was kind of just waiting around for the next batter in the lineup, which wouldn't really be so bad. But then the editor was on vacation and he needed a couple of days to actually do the job once he got back. So, a couple days for A and B and then C, it starts to stack up and then you're 10 days into the month and the whole goddamn podcast goes down on iTunes and then you gotta rush in to put out that fire, which means taking that line, a less Christian coast to coast hosted by a more mellow Alex Jones, had to take that out of the description. And I think just that keyword, Alex Jones, honestly had something to do with it, but it's hard to say because Apple never gave me any information at all. They just flipped the switch off. I pruned up my podcast description and they flipped it back on. And kudos to our shadowy anonymous podcast editor, because he got this back to me a bit faster than expected. He clearly busted his ass. So respect. And I'm confident we're back on track now. It's just getting tougher to keep up when running such a lean operation. But there are many ways to make sure you get notified when a new episode comes out, so you don't have to keep checking and checking and rechecking. Hopefully you use a podcast catcher app that does it all for you, or just follow me on Facebook or Twitter. I almost never say that because I really don't care if you follow me on Facebook or Twitter. I don't even say very much there except to announce new episodes. So if that's what you want, that's where you'll get it. And for Plus, you can actually click on the website's podcast player and set up email notifications. That seems to be a pretty convenient thing that people have liked doing if they need that. I just like to make sure everybody knows what's available, even if you don't take advantage of it. Because I did get several emails the past few weeks with Plus questions. In case there are other people out there with questions of their own, if you go to the HiresideChatsPlus.com, there is a Help Frequently Asked Questions page. Everyone who's even halfway interested in Plus should just read that. It's everything you're going to want to know. Step-by-step photo instructions for plugging Plus into apps on both Android and Apple phones. You really don't have to ever go to the website if you just plug in the Plus feed into one of these apps like you would any other podcast. Podcast Addict is the one that I use most on Android. It never fails. I'm sorry if you already know this stuff, but, you know, you get half a dozen emails and you start thinking, yeah, I never really communicate these things. I just kind of assume people will figure it out, but some don't. And then they hesitate to become Plus members because of these sorts of technological hurdles and the ambiguity and the gray area. But you can also sign up for the Patreon. It is the same thing, but if you're familiar with Patreon, then you might feel that it is more user-friendly. Don't let some uncertainty or technological hurdle stop you from becoming a Plus member or enjoying the second hour of all these great interviews. You know, your iTunes goes down. Sure, it might have been somewhat technical rather than content related, but we also got a content strike on YouTube again for episode 69, some show way back in the beginning when I was still numbering them. These things happen, and I do have to wonder, like, am I going to be able to do this show in 20 years? Maybe I should put a little more energy and fuel into the pitch for the premium version. And I know everybody's probably wondering what was in this Plus show. Well, I'm going to tell you, we talked about Arizona's own Nazca Lines. Did you know that? Did you know Arizona had a Nazca Lines type thing? The Blythe Intaglios. How about that? Google that. We also talked about the secrets and rumors of the Grand Canyon, Charles Dutton, the U.S. Reclamation Act, Seth Tanner and the Forbidden Cave story, the Sedona Vortexes, deocculting John McCain's Freemasonic funeral ritual. Now that was interesting. There's a lot of weird things about McCain's funeral. Of course, he was an Arizona senator, and a lot of Masonic numbers coming up and all kinds of stuff. Did he even really die? I don't know. But we also talked about Trump, magic, and the Jesuits, as well as the Black Eye Club. Did you know that a ton of politicians and actors and just general oligarchs have had some pretty brutal black eyes and no real answer for them? It's interesting. And for people who did hear the Plus show, it was nice to talk to someone who can say, yeah, some weird stuff is going on with Trump. He's doing some moon magic stuff. He's clearly got some esoteric advisors, etc. Without jumping on the Trump Q bandwagon, you know? I think we did all right with that. I think we towed that line, as opposed to a few weeks ago. Again, Plus people, you're the only ones who know what I'm talking about. And that's okay with me. Also, in today's Plus show, that little anecdote about the glass company working on military contracts, harnessing new properties of light. That was pretty damn interesting. See, I don't always need an author promoting a new book. Sometimes people just out in the world get little breadcrumbs to really out their stuff. And that's what I want those open lines to be. You know, these joint sessions we're doing, give me your insights, your stories, the little glimpses and clues that you've gotten at the Big Beast. Last time I felt like it was a little more about promoting people and fighting over dietary choices, although the Unabomber caller was pretty damn compelling. More of that. And remember the next joint session where I sit here, smoke and drink, and answer your Skype calls, or Zoom calls technically, will be on the 25th of October. Not that long now. Coming up quick. Either way, just to close this plus thing out, sign up for the whole shebang. If you're listening on your phone right now, you can just click the text in the show description that talks about signing up for plus. It's a big link. You click it, you put in your card. 2 seconds later, you add the new RSS feed. Now you got plus and we're best friends. But as I said, we're back in full swing. I have the second and third shows of the month recorded already. They're going to the editor. One of them is a return guest who is a preserver of an oral tradition, or should I say saga. And the other is a pretty perfect guest for this whole what's up with free energy devices, ether physics, and flying saucers kick I've been on, because he runs those conferences. So I know you're going to love him, and I'm out of here. I've done my part. Your move, ancient secret keepers, giant bone hiders, and Freemasons of Phoenix. Your fucking move. You're gonna love this song too. And I kid the Freemasons.
You would hardly recognize me. I'm so glad. Now I'm a Mason. I don't care about you. Why do I bother when you're not in the club with me? Will make you who you are. How can a person